tonight on The Download. From the new film, Call Me By Your Name, actor Michael Stuhlbarg, Broadway actor and singer Ashley Brown, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Now, here's your host, a man who also performed on Broadway, Justin Kaufman.
Technically, Broadway. It's more Lawrence and Broadway. Small studio theater that's now a purse store. But it, really good stuff. Really strong stuff. If you get a chance. I mean, technically it's off Broadway. Off Broadway. Because it was on Cullum. That joke just never gets old, right? It's such a great Chicago joke. Hey, everybody. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Wow, we have a sensational show lined up. I am in awe of the talent that is coming through tonight. Michael Stuhlbarg is one of the best character actors working today in film, television. He played Rothstein on the show Boardwalk Empire, the HBO smash hit. He's also in the show Fargo. He was in A Serious Man. He is in the new movie Call Me By Your Name. Michael Stuhlbarg in studio. We'll talk with him about his career and what drew him to this script, which this film nominated for a Golden Globe. Look at us, huh? It's not every day. I feel like there's a lot of talent that has come through The Download over the past year is being recognized for their work at the Golden Globes and probably the Oscars. I was thinking about it. Florida Project, Sean Baker, who came through and talked about his film, which I remember at the time being like, this is haunting. It's depressing. It's not. There's no walking on sunshine in that film. There's no like, yeah, I feel good. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na. Nope. They skipped that montage for the Florida Project. And Call Me By Your Name is a tremendous film. And it's also nominated for a Golden Globe. So we'll talk with Michael Stuhlbarg. Also tonight, Ashley Brown's back on the program. Broadway star who was who played Mary Poppins in the Mary Poppins Broadway musical in 2006. She was also Belle in Beauty and the Beast. She's coming for the Merry Merry Chicago show, the tradition down at Chicago Symphony Center. Starts, I think, in 2 days. Ashley Brown was on the show last year. We talked about Christmas music. We'll talk again tonight. Great to have her back. I love it that we are at the point, Pete, where we can be like, return engagement. Welcome back to the show. That kind of stuff. Also, the two guys, Dan and Jeff, behind Potted Potter, the parody of Harry Potter, where they take seven books and cram it into 70 minutes. It's playing at the Broadway Playhouse right here at Water Tower. Talk with those guys who have really, I mean, have from West End to New York to Chicago to touring all over the world. This has become a sensation, this comedy around Harry Potter. We'll talk about not only Harry Potter and keeping it fresh, but how do they keep a show fresh? Doing a parody over and over and over and over, city after city. We'll talk with those guys coming up tonight. Also, Greg Flam's here for the swap meet. 80 Quig is in for Mike Fouché and the Daily Line. We've got a lot to talk about when it comes to local politics, whether it's Emmanuel on Stephen Colbert. More importantly, today, the Cook County Board, the commissioners voting to put on marijuana on the ballot coming up here in 2018. So it's advisory. It's not anything that's more than, it's not a referendum or anything like that. Just that kind of thing. Like, would you be interested? That kind of question. But we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about Joe Berrios and Forrest Claypool. Who I got to say, I miss a little bit. It's only been a couple days, but I miss him. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, do the carry out. So stay with us. It's The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here today's top stories. Doug Jones beat Roy Moore in Alabama, and social media was filled with hashtags and tears of joy emojis. Really? You were that invested in the Alabama Senate race that you shed digital tears? The media has seized upon this upset victory, which I guess was an upset, by saying the Republicans didn't run a good campaign and this is a sign for the 2018 midterms. Again, really? I don't know. Alabama's definitely a red state, but Democrats won by what, 10,000 votes against a grown-ass man who likes to date by yearbook? I mean, shouldn't it have been a landslide? I feel for conservative voters in Alabama. They had no choice. If the Democrats had a bad candidate with scandal all over him or her, voters would just find excuses to skip the polls, too. I don't know. There's a Reba marathon on Lifetime, and today is a perfect day to inspect all my light bulbs. That was my Alabama accent. I'm trying something different, you know.
Hey, up here. Check it out, up here.
President Trump did his best vote for Roy Moore earlier in the week and then followed with the I wouldn't have voted for Roy Moore via Twitter today. He definitely gets the blame for the loss, as presidents before him do when they lose these kind of elections. But the Republican Party is putting this loss on the shoulders of Steve Bannon. I guess he's the guy to blame for putting up Roy Moore to begin with. But let's be clear, if Roy Moore didn't like to take high school seniors to the Cracker Barrel for some Saturday night foreplay, Bannon would have another Trumpian senator in the mix. He may have lost, but it's the battle, not the war. Darth Vader didn't quit when they blew up the first Death Star. No, I should have said spoiler alert. I didn't want to give that away. Ah, that's in A New Hope. Ah, I did it again. You never can tell with these Star Wars movies. Like Pete Zimmerman, he doesn't watch any of them. Anyway, there's a guy named Obi-Wan. I'll tell you after the show. But who needs Roy Moore? The Republicans say they have a deal on the tax bill. Trump wanted it before Christmas, and it looks like he's going to get it. No word on actually what's in it. That'll trickle out. Or is it trickle down? Oh, gotcha. Well, we'll find out. And when we do find out, we're going to find out this way. Why does the TurboTax keep stalling? Why won't it let me click that box? I gave all those old clothes to Goodwill. Where do I put the dollar amount that I just pulled out of my ass for all those clothes that I gave to Goodwill? It's not an option anymore. Or in my case, I'll just wait and let my accountant surprise me. She'll type a bunch of stuff while I sit there silently and hope she doesn't sigh too much. But hey, if the new tax plan does what the president says it's going to do and puts more money in my pocket, to that I say, hey, let's hear him out. If it doesn't and I'm somehow worse off than I was before, well, then I say, what about the deficit? And there you go. In other White House news, Omarosa resigned today. You know what? Can't pass. I was more of a Survivor fan anyway. The CTA is jacking up the rates. A full quarter, $250 for a one-way ticket. Can I still use my old tokens? There's a silver lining to this rate hike. It'll be the first time in years where the CTA will not be cutting services. So the buses will run, but they will cost more. I guess that's better than not running and costing more. Also, why stop at $250? I'd at least get it up to solid bills, like a $3, right? But who's got $3? Just keep going. Go straight to $5. Everybody's got fives. It's easier just for basic math. $5. In weather, nice enough for December. Flurries, always acceptable. Who doesn't love a flurry? Supposed to get in the 40s next week. And in Alaska, 15 inches of snow fell in just 90 minutes yesterday. 15 inches in 90 minutes. Wildfires will get Cali. Hurricanes are going to get Florida. Snow, that's what's going to get us. Something like that. That or flying Asian carp. Also, there's a media shower tonight. In sports, don't look now, but the streak is still intact. The Bears, Bulls, and Blackhawks have gone undefeated since Friday. The Hawks kept it going with a win over Florida last night at the UC. That's 3 in a row for them after dropping 5 in a row, but we won't talk about that. Streaks, not just for windows anymore. But it's nice to see, and it kind of coincides with the return of goalie Corey Crawford. So next time we want to start thinking about a crowless hockey team in Chicago, maybe don't. Back at it tomorrow night against the upstart Winnipeg Jets. The Bulls have won 3 in a row, and it's been on the backs of the dynamic duo Bobby Portis and Nikola Mirotic. After they won against the Celtics on Monday, the headlines were all about the 1-2 punch. Get it? The 1-2 punch. Everybody did it. Like, it was 5 different people did. Oh, the 1-2 punch. When asked about the preseason fight that landed Mirotic in the hospital with a broken face, both players said they're past it. What I don't get is, how does Nikola not have to wear one of those see-through face masks? Right? The Bill Laimbeer special? I'm starting to think that this fight never happened. It's like the moon landing or Roy Moore signing that yearbook. It's all fake news. Bulls get the Jazz tonight at the UC. Right now winning by 2 in the first. Keep it going, Bulls. The Bears are practicing earlier than usual this week because for some dumb reason, the Bears play on Saturday this week instead of Sunday. They'll head to Detroit City to take on the Lions. The Lions are still in the hunt for a playoff spot, although it's a long shot. The Bears are still in the hunt to finish up 7-9, which would be better than what most people thought. The beginning of the season. Adam Shaheen had such a great game last week that he was promoted to the injury report with a chest injury. That's usually how it works. You start to play well for the Bears and you get next week you're out for the year. It's Bear football at its best right there. This will mark the first time in Mitch Trubisky's career that he'll see a team for the second time. He lost to the Lions in a game we should have won. Earlier in the season, the Bears are confident he'll make the adjustments that he's seen this defense before. Yeah, that's usually how it works. Remember Jay Cutler versus the Packers? He'd seen them so many times that he kept forgetting that Charles Woodson was standing right where he wanted to throw it every time. Speaking of old Bears, Devin Hester retired yesterday. Now a real Hall of Fame debate rages over whether or not to let the primarily kick returner into Canton. He holds all the records, but rarely do special team players make it. But Devin Hester was special. I say Hall of Famer just for the fact that he single-handedly changed how football was watched. Punts is when you went up to go to the bathroom or refill the old queso. Not with Hester. You did all that extracurricular stuff when Rex Grossman was on the field. Hester, you got up in front of the TV. The winter meetings continue in Orlando. The Cubs got Tyler Chatwood and Brandon Morrow. And last night, they announced they signed lefty Drew Smyly. Another reclamation project, perhaps. Smyly was a highly touted young kid with Detroit and Tampa. He signed big bucks to pitch in Seattle last year, but had Tommy John surgery before the season even started. So the Cubs go in on a starter who didn't pitch one strike last year. But if he comes back, steal for the little money that they're investing. Sounds very Jake Arrieta-y by Theo and the Cubs. And when Smyly becomes dominant, let him walk. Let his beard grow and let him walk somewhere else. And finally tonight, robots are being used to shoo homeless people away from buildings in San Francisco. Yep, robot police. Like RoboCop without Ronnie Cox. Man, is it more like a beeps boops like R2-D2? Beep boop 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 boop. Or do the robots talk? Hey, buddy, you have to go home, but you don't have to stay here. Reprogram. Got the line wrong. Sorry. Tell it to the judge. That's the carryout for December 13, 2017. Hey, just 12 days till Christmas. I feel a song coming on. Nah, never mind. That was just gas. All right, coming up, AD Quigg from the Daily Line is going to join us. Talk local politics. At 8 o'clock, Michael Stuhlbarg, one of the greatest character actors working today, from his new film, Call Me By Your Name. It's coming up tonight on The Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
You know, it just dawned on me that we just ran that prostate commercial, and then they've got the voiceover guy with the really big booming voice. Clearly, his prostate's doing just fine. I mean, it's just,
is that the mark of a good prostate?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess mine's fine too. Then I guess.
Just say, you're in a pristine.
How you
prostate.
Doing?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good.
What's going on?
It's good to be on. I'm excited. Got a big show tonight.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun. Good people coming through. Greg's on. AD Quigg's in for Fouché. So we've got a good lineup coming up tonight.
I'll be listening.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coppin. Well, it's Wednesday, so that means it's time to check in on all things local politics with the Daily Line. Usually Mike Fouché's in, but tonight, AD Quigg, reporter at the Daily Line, is in for him in his stead. We got a lot to talk about. We talk about Joe Berrios, Forrest Claypool, CPS, and of course, marijuana, which shows up, could be showing up at a ballot coming to you soon.
It will be.
AD Quigg, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's first talk about, if we can, let's talk about Joe Berrios, the assessor, the Cook County assessor. An interesting story, a four-part series comes out in the Tribune about something that I guess we all kind of know as Chicagoans, that if you're rich and you can hire tax lawyers, you can exploit loopholes and get your property taxes decreased. This is something that's been going on. I know, and I'm like, I wish I had a lawyer, that kind of thing. But I mean, this is obviously putting pressure once again on the tax system here in the city of Chicago, but directly on Assessor Berrios.
Right. So Joe Berrios is the man in charge of assessing property in Cook County, and Jason Grotto with the Tribune, now with ProPublica, did a massive four-part investigation of how the assessment system works and basically found out that it was very inequitable and structurally did not have a fair and balanced way of assessing property. So people in low-income communities and small business owners in low-income communities were having their properties over-assessed, and wealthier homeowners and commercial and industrial property owners were being assessed at a lower rate. So they're basically getting a tax break and also winning on appeals of their assessments over and over. This is one of the first big concrete things that has been pinned on Berrios, showing, you know, I think the Tribune said it well, that he's not doing his job well.
Right.
And he also happens to be up for election in 2018. So this is a huge
deal for him. What a lot of people don't know, he's also co-chair of the Cook County Democrats, if not the chair. I mean, he's run Democrat politics in Cook County for years.
Right.
And he's a big player. So there is some question about whether or not he's giving breaks to some people who might be funders for Democrat politics in Cook County by assessing their property at a lower value.
Yeah, he's been criticized for a long time for accepting campaign donations from property tax appeals attorneys. And the fourth part of this investigation showed that big firms owned by Mike Madigan and Alderman Ed Burke were some of the biggest recipients of breaks.
Again, and I don't consider myself an expert, but I consider myself well-read. That story is one that I have head-scratched for years in Chicago about how the biggest and most powerful and prominent politicians on the Democrat side are also making money off of the system, whether through their own law firms. Alderman Ed Burke comes to mind, also the Speaker, Mike Madigan. Yeah, and quick to jump in on this, Governor Rauner coming out.
Calling for him to resign.
Wants Berrios to resign, but more importantly, has found a way to connect Mike Madigan to this, J.B. Pritzker to this, to find a way to sort of call out the Chicago way to all Illinois voters.
An unholy trifecta, I think he called it. And, you know, these are the big villains that Rauner has been pointing to for a very long time. Another Democratic gubernatorial candidate also pounced on this, Chris Kennedy, who's been saying we need to fix this system and make it equitable for everyone, which is interesting. He's one of very few Democrats who have come out to criticize Berrios.
I think of Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. I think of the mayor of Chicago and Rahm Emanuel. Are they on the record with Joe Berrios?
President Preckwinkle was slated with Joe Berrios for the 2018 primary by the Cook County Democratic Party, stood by him again today and said, you know, if the voters want to kick out Joe Berrios, they have that option on March 20th.
So he's not resigning. If anything,
He's said
he had some nice things to say about the governor and about the candidate and Chris Kennedy, saying, if you don't like it, why don't you give back all the money from your property?
Right, because Chris Kennedy and J.B. Pritzker have both benefited from property tax appeals. I mean, it's their right to appeal. And Berrios has said the system is fair because there is a redress. People can appeal their property tax assessments. His lead challenger in 2018 has said, why don't we just do it right the first time and make sure the assessments are appropriate?
There's something to be said that this is becoming more and more of a hotbed issue, because just in the last year and in the years coming up here, the city of Chicago has had to raise and raise and raise property taxes. So I won't say the first time it's you know, a heavy tax burden to citizens of the city of Chicago, taxpayers, but it's getting more and more obvious in that regard. So when you see that there's inequities and people who have a lot of money are finding ways to cheat the system, it's more pronounced now than it might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right. And what a lot of people, what it took me a while to understand, is that for every break that these big industrial properties are getting, the tax levy is the same countywide. So whenever someone isn't paying, you have to pay a little bit more. So and his name is going to be the name that shows up. You know, people see that name on their property tax bill and see the property tax bill going up and have a name to.
Yeah. And I'm very interested in the political side of this, because Berrios quickly came out against Governor Rauner and used what the Democrats seem to be using, which is, you're not in charge. The phrase he used, Rauner used in an interview not too long ago, saying, I'm not in charge. Mike Madigan's in charge of the state. Now they're pouncing on that. Governor Rauner looks like he's pouncing on the idea that this is what he's going to run with in general election, the idea of the Democrats are all in cahoots, the Chicago way. You got Berrios, Madigan, Burke, all the way down, J.B. Pritzker, all the way down the line.
Right.
I mean, are we seeing, I mean, is Berrios and this issue really kind of seeing this election and what the issues are going to be kind of sussed out?
Preview of it, perhaps? It's an interesting intersection of all the things that people, it's the Chicago way stuff that people bring up all the time. It's high taxes, it's an unfair system, it's rich, entrenched politicians winning out in the end. The other thing to keep in mind is that there is an independent analysis of the assessment system going on that the county called for. I will be very interested to see those results.
A.D. Quigg, reporter with the Daily Line, in studio tonight talking all things local. We'll talk about Forrest Claypool, who resigned at the end of last week, and we'll also talk about the new ballot initiative measure that's out that'll be about
the
marijuana.
Referendum.
The referendum.
I didn't come up with it. That was John Fritchie.
And John Fritchie. Good job, John. AD Quigg in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. AD Quigg, reporter at Daily Line, with me in studio. We're talking all things local politics. Forrest Claypool, I would say now you can use the word long time. CPS CEO, resigned at the end of last week after an IG, an Inspector General investigation into hiring a lawyer who was a friend of his. I mean, the way I kind of broke it down is he hired a friend and then lied about it. That's pretty accurate.
That's pretty close. The school's inspector general said he repeatedly lied during an investigation of a hiring of a friend who was brought on to help the district bring a lawsuit against the state over school funding. And he was still getting a payout from a former employer, and that former employer was helping with the lawsuit, so there was a conflict there. And there were several rounds of ethics decisions that said you shouldn't do this. And then Claypool brought in another friend.
I was going to say, my favorite part of that story is there were six different decisions that said this is a conflict, don't do it. And he's like, let's go to a seventh. And he got the seventh to be like, yeah, sounds good for us. He's like, hey, get rid of the other six. We got a winner. I mean, it's so classic politics.
Well, his argument was everything was done so I could fight for school funding for our kids.
Right.
And that was kind of the crowning achievement of his time in office was winning more state funding.
Now, the idea that this being a scandal, that he hired a friend to do this to fight for more school funding, it does. I mean, what's happening with politics today and all the scandals that are exploding left and right when it comes to our representatives and our people who work in government, this is kind of small potatoes. And now it's obvious to me that that's an issue that he lied to cover it up. But what does the city of Chicago and more importantly, Chicago Public Schools lose by losing their leader over a scandal that essentially doesn't own up to some of the other scandals we're seeing out there?
I mean, it's bad that CPS has had this many CEOs and kind of a lack of stability. I think a lot of parents have already been struggling with, we've had school closures. We have had funding issues for a very long time. We had this fight over the teacher's contract. It's just been totally unstable. And it just doesn't look good to have another one fired in scandal after what happened with Barbara Bird Bennett. I think a lot of some teachers are excited to see a fellow teacher now at the head.
Janice Jackson.
Right. She was chief education officer since 2015. Before that, she was a principal and a social studies teacher. CTU is excited to have an educator at the helm. I think she comes with a different perspective than Claypool did because he was not an educator. He was a Mr. Fix-It.
Well, that's my question about him. He's bounced around from department to department, whether it's with Mayor Daley or Mayor Emanuel. He also ran for office here and there. Is this the end of Forrest Claypool as we know him, as a name that we've known in Chicago politics for quite a while now?
How many people in Chicago politics really go away? That's the only thing I'll say about it. And he got a very nice send-off from the mayor. I mean, they've been friends for close to 40 years. First met on a downstate congressional campaign in the 80s and have been friends ever since. His resignation was like a very nice retirement party, greatest hits of Forrest Claypool. So he got the best send-off that he could. He said he made a stupid mistake. And I mean,
and frankly, gets to avoid what happens in 2018 when it hits summertime and they go, you know what, we're just out of money.
Yeah.
You know, we need to go back. They're going to, you know, I don't have a lot of faith that everything has been fixed by the battle for school funding in the state. I just have this sneaking suspicion that CPS will be knocking on the door again.
Yeah. They've had a very deep hole to dig out of for a long time. The state funding helped a lot, but it's supposed to take a long time to really help as well. They've got some long-term debt to deal with.
All right. Our last story tonight has to do with marijuana. The Cook County Board today decided, was it unanimous? Did I read it was unanimous?
It was unanimous.
That they are going to put a question on the ballot coming up here in 2018.
Yes.
An advisory question. Now, what's the question?
So the question is, you know, rolls right off the tongue. Shall the state of Illinois legalize the cultivation, manufacture, distribution, testing, and sale of marijuana and marijuana products for recreational use by adults 21 and older, subject to state regulation, taxation, and local ordinance?
Mm.
So basically, should recreational marijuana be available for people above 21?
And obviously unanimous at the Cook County Board. What's the impetus to do this? Why put this on the ballot?
Basically, as a thing to point to say the people want this.
It's non-binding. It's not something if it wins, it gets 50%, we have to do. It's essentially just a message being sent to Springfield.
Yeah. And there are lawmakers in Springfield who for a long time have said, you know, this would be good for our criminal justice system. We wouldn't have so many marijuana arrests. It wouldn't be stressing our public defenders and state's attorneys to prosecute these low-level drug offenses. And there's a ton of revenue in it. I mean, we've seen what it's like for Colorado and California after they did recreational, and Illinois Washington could use the money.
You saw that. Democrats, senators in downstate Illinois, Heather Staines being one, brought this up about a week ago, saying we got to really take a look at recreational marijuana. As you mentioned, Commissioner Fritchie and the Cook County Board. I mean, do you see this being an issue? Is this something that's going to be an issue that'll come up in the general election coming up here for gubernatorial?
Yeah, sure.
Is it something that we'll see the state of Illinois get serious about if the answer comes back that, you know, 80%, 90% of Cook County residents are for it?
I mean, we've already seen gubernatorial candidates talking about it. J.B. Pritzker is in favor of legalization. Daniel Biss is in favor of legalization. Chris Kennedy is in favor of decriminalization. I think it's already an issue. It's been picking up steam, mm-hmm. especially as, you know, Illinois keeps looking at its bank books and seeing red, red, red. I think the revenue thing is very appealing to people. And John Fritchie says this will be overwhelmingly in favor.
The only issue I have is that we, it seems, very reluctantly adapted medical marijuana. It's one of the more restrictive programs in the country when it comes to state regulation.
Yeah, it's a limited number of conditions.
So what makes us think that the state of Illinois is ready and progressive enough to take on a big issue like legalizing recreational marijuana?
I think it will depend a lot on who the governor is after 2018. If we do have a governor who's for this, and this governor has to come up with another budget, I think that will be a big driver.
All right. Well, we'll pay attention. A.D. Quigg, a reporter at The Daily Line. You can find it at thedailyline.net. Of course, covers everything here in Chicago, Cook County, and they cover Springfield as well. She'll be back with us again next Wednesday. A.D., thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is starring in the new film, Call Me By Your Name. The indie coming-of-age drama is opening in select theaters after a great showing at Sundance and other film festivals. Michael Stuhlbarg plays a professor whose family summers in Italy while welcoming an American grad student to help and stay and help with the research. The film focuses on the love affair between the professor's son and the grad student played by Armie Hammer. The film is stunning, shot on location in northern Italy, and the acting, the actors are tremendous. You know Stuhlbarg from his work, TV and film. He starred as mobster Arnold Rothstein on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. He's also on Fargo on FX. He's also been seen in films like Hugo, Blue Jasmine, Doctor Strange, Steve Jobs, Trumbo, and A Serious Man, in which he was nominated for a Golden Globe. Michael Stuhlbarg, my guest tonight, The Big Table. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Amazing film, and I'm going to ask you about a lot of questions about acting because there's a lot of your career is one that is just marvelous when you think about all the diverse and distinct roles that you've taken on.
Thanks.
What was it about this film and this script that attracted you?
Everything about this one was, I mean, from reading written by James Ivory on the cover of the script to working getting a chance to work with Luca Guadagnino, the director of the film, knowing that it was going to be shot in northern Italy, and the role itself, of course, was one of those wonderful, simple yet deceivingly difficult kinds of parts, in that I was responsible for knowing Italian and mm-hmm. being a Latin and Greek scholar, as well as familiar with and passionate about archaeology and art history. So there was a lot of information to absorb and then to hopefully regurgitate it, so to speak, out, to sound like, at least, like I knew what I was talking about.
Well, the film is one of these scripts in Hollywood or projects in Hollywood that people have known about for a while. I mean, I think it's been 10 years in development.
Pretty close to
Did
that,
you
yeah.
know about that? Did you know about the short
No,
the
I knew
story
nothing
came...
about it. Not a thing. The whole thing came to me through my agent. Luca contacted them and said, would I be interested in reading the script? I said, of course. And I read it and fell for every aspect of it. and just jumped at the opportunity.
The challenge of being a professor and all the things that you mentioned, you play a father in this, and you play it in a way that, you know, this, like I mentioned at the top, you're in northern Italy, it's summering, it's a grad student comes to stay. But talk about the dual role of both having to master being a professor, but at the same time having to master being a father.
I don't know if anyone ever masters being either,
right,
honestly.
Right.
So I cut myself a little bit of slack there. But it's just one of those things, you get a script plunked down in front of you like this, and you just sort of absorb as much as you can in the time that you have. And I think I have found in thinking on this that the demands of the role in a wonderful way mirror the kind of man he is. He's passionate about art. He's passionate about the past. Mm-hmm. And he mines it daily and provokes his students to think on the past as being as alive as the present. Now, that being said, I think you can sort of tie that to what he thinks about probably being a father as well, in that he encourages his son during the course of the story to hold on to those things in his life that make him feel alive. That he, the love that he happens to find coming into his life, the young boy, I mean, he watches his son fall in love. He eventually expresses some beautiful sentiments at the end of the film when you get to see the professor watching his son go through all this, to sort of say, feel what you're feeling, be alive now, don't push away what you're going through, because as adults, we often do that.
Right. It's the takeaway of the film.
Part of it,
It's love. I kind of say romantic coming-of-age drama, but it's love, it's loss, but it's passion. Yeah. And that's what really draws the viewer in, is that this is an examination, an exploration of passion.
Absolutely. And not just a physical passion or emotional passion, but a passion of the mind as well. I think that we get to see very bright people becoming overwhelmed by their heart as well.
Does that read on a script when you're an actor and you read the script and you're like, oh, this is a great story, I love it? Or does that come out in the directing or the editing? Where does that, when you are talking about a film like this where passion is the sentiment that's left behind after the viewer leaves the theater?
Sometimes that can be articulated in the dialogue on the page, and you get a sense of, wow, this person is passionate about what they've been, you know, what they say. And sometimes it's absolutely underneath the text. And I guess that's one of the wonderful things about what Luca does with this film, is that there are spans in which there are labyrinthine chunks of dialogue that in and of themselves may not say very much, but in the context in which they're spoken, or perhaps with the emotion underneath them as to what's actually happening in the room when they're speaking them, you get a sense of this passion you're speaking of underneath the words.
And I would say, as actors and directors, another part of the passion that plays out is what's not being said.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the beautiful things that I guess I meant to articulate, was that Luca lets the film breathe. It's as if you can see something growing when no text is spoken, even more than when things are spoken.
Actor Michael Stuhlbarg in studio with us tonight. He is one of the stars of the new film, Call Me By Your Name, which is in select theaters. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Michael Stuhlbarg at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Michael Stuhlbarg. Great to have you here. The actor from Call Me By Your Name, the indie coming-of-age romantic drama, which is in select theaters now. It did well in the film festival, Sundance, Toronto, Chicago, other places. As you come to town to be in places and do the talkbacks and be around the film, do you like that part of it? Do you like the part of the process of going to film festivals and being a part of it?
If you're passionate about the filmmaking, it's wonderful to actually get a chance to talk to people about it when it's coming out. I love it. And everybody takes away something different. And it's really enlightening in a lot of ways to get a chance to talk to people about it. So I enjoy this process.
When it's at film festivals, is it nerve-wracking as an actor when people haven't seen it yet, or there's buzz around it and you get to be in the same audience with people who haven't seen it or might be first-time viewing?
Well, I love to sit in an audience with an audience, you know, to sit with the audience and listen to how they're reacting to something when you know what's coming up here and there. They have us moving around an awful lot to talk to a lot of people, mm-hmm. so we don't get to sit with each audience and listen to their reactions. We get to meet them right after, most often, they've just seen the film. So I'm going to see the film again tonight because I haven't seen it since the Sundance Festival, almost a year ago now. So I'm excited to experience it again with an audience and remember what it was like to make it, and I hope I can... I'm just looking forward to seeing it again.
Taking us back to Sundance, when you did see it for the first time, is that what it does? It brings you back to memories of shooting it and the memories of what was positive? Talk about the experience of seeing a film that you shot and have not seen yet for the first time.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful keepsake of the joy we had in the making of the film. I mean, we all kind of hit it off really quickly from the beginning. And to be in Crema, where we shot the film up north, about 45 minutes outside of Milan, and Moscazzano, a tiny little city nearby Crema, it's a really evocative place. And, the wonderful thing about film is that it takes you to places like this. And if you can't get there, films take you around the world and make you or allow you to experience what life is like elsewhere. And I love that about what I get to do.
You've had such a great career, both TV and film, also on stage, starting on stage.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear you talk about being in film and what film does for you to be able to go anywhere around the world.
Yeah.
Those mediums, those different platforms, they give you different things. Talk about starting your career on the stage. You obviously now have a career in which you were film after film after film after film, but do you miss those days of that moment, that passion of being in front of an audience and doing it over and over?
I do. I love that, and it hasn't left me, and I'm hoping to do some theater this year. It's been too long since I've been on the stage, and I'm looking forward to getting back into it again. And yes, there's nothing like, you know, telling a story in front of an audience and living through it together, experiencing it together. And I have missed it, and I look forward to doing more of it. Each of these mediums has their challenges, and, you know, making films is a really challenging thing as well. Each has their pluses and their minuses, and I've been grateful and thankful that I am grateful and thankful that I've been able to do both, and I hope to continue to do so.
Is it challenging to go back and forth between mediums and to... be someone who's doing film after film and then have maybe a play in the middle there?
Right.
And is it challenging just because each platform asks something different of
right.
the actor?
Right. To be completely honest with you, it's been a very long time since I've done a play. Back in 2008 was the last time I did a play, and I happened to get cast right after that play by the Coen brothers in their film A Serious Man. And since then, my life kind of took a left turn. And I've been doing film and television ever since with every intention to get back to doing
right.
plays. But scheduling has been complicated because
right.
I've been very busy, but happily so. The work informs each other. There's a kind of confidence you have on stage, or that one must have, to tell a story that's 2 or 3 hours long. And you are the conduit for the energy of the evening. So there is... It's your energy.
Right.
It's your responsibility to help tell that story, and there's great responsibility on your shoulders in that sense. Whereas when you're making a film, it's over a long period of time. You only touch each scene one day, and you kind of have to come in to the project with your ideas about what you want to do, or at least have some thoughts about it, and then explore it on the day. At least that's my game plan usually. Each is an art form. Each has its own craft. And there are certain tools you use for one that can be enhanced by the other. And I'd like to believe and hope that when I jump back on the stage again, that what I've been doing for the last 10 years will inform what I will have learned something valuable to share on stage.
All the platforms, television as well, discipline plays a big part
yeah.
of it. And I think of anyone who acts in films and does it over and over and over like you do in all the films that I mentioned, you'd spend 3 months, if not longer, on a project. Every day is, like you said, one scene or, right. or two scenes. There's a lot that goes into it about to be ready and prepared as an actor because you really don't have a lot of time. But at the same time, it's an expansive experience.
You're responsible. They give you this responsibility when they give you a role and they say, you know, we think you can do this. give it a try. And if you're lucky, you've got some time to work on it. In some cases, you don't get a lot of time. And in some cases on television shows, they give you fresh pages on the day you show up.
Wow.
And you have to do the best you can to make it work. And there's a million ways to go about doing that.
Michael Stuhlbarg's my guest tonight at the big table. His new film, Call Me By Your Name, is out in select theaters after great showing at Sundance and other film festivals like Toronto and here in Chicago. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on the news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation because I want to talk to you about being a character actor. You have done so much in your career, whether it's Boardwalk Empire or Hugo, Doctor Strange. I mean, you have done things that are so distinct and diverse. We'll talk about what it takes to get into those roles. Michael Stuhlbarg, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, my guest at the big table tonight, Michael Stuhlbarg, the great actor who is starring in the new film, Call Me By Your Name. You know, you've done so many great films. It's amazing to look at your resume and see all and even the television work. Fargo is great. Boardwalk Empire was fantastic. But the one thing that you take away from all the roles that you play is that there is a distinction. This is a diverse canon of work. Do you look for that? I mean, as you as an actor, are you
Absolutely.
Constantly looking for new challenges or do something that you didn't do the last
it's
time?
It's essential to what I would like in my life is, yes, diversity and as different things and as challenging things as can be thrown at me. That's what, you know, excites me about this work, to try to do things that I might be frightened of or that scare the hell out of me or challenge me in ways that I had never thought I would be challenged, whether it's, you know, trying to pretend to be a gangster from the 20s or, you know, the guy who created the Macintosh computer.
Right, right.
I try to select as carefully as I can the things that come along, but honestly, these things just tend to come into my life, and I just am grateful that people think of me as a candidate for these roles.
You mentioned in there, is there fear with the
every
challenges
day.
Every day when you look in a new script and you're like, I want to do this, but I'm not sure if I can?
Yeah. Sure, that's part of the fun. I think if you surprise yourself, you'll surprise other people. All you can do is sort of submerge yourself in the world of each of these projects and play, you know? Inform yourself, whether it's an historical character or a fictional character. Surround yourself with as much knowledge about them as you can, and on the day you play and see what comes out.
Are you the kind of actor who goes deep on the research to prepare yourself for a role, like with the professor and Call Me By Your Name? Are you spending time learning about archaeology
sure.
or art history and that thing?
Yeah, I mean, I approached a friend who was a classics major. I talked to a Latin and Greek scholar when I was in Milan. I went to an Italian tutor in New York. I went to another Italian tutor when I got to Italy. The first one was from the south of Italy. The second one was from the north of Italy, and the story was in the north, so I had to relearn the things I had learned from
right,
the person from
right.
the south. And you combine all that stuff, and it informs what you have to say, and you bring your own life experience with it, and you hope it's new to yourself as well as to others. Ideally, you surprise yourself in the doing of it. And it's a real collaboration as well. You can't forget that things don't come to life while you're, you know, alone. There's everybody else. There's so many, you know, other people who are involved in the collaborative process, be it the costume designer, the people who help us with hair and makeup, the director, you know, the other actors. It comes to life when we open our hearts to each other and create something together.
When you're a successful actor and you're in a position where you can choose the roles that you want, scripts come through, is it imperative for you to let your management team and other people around you say, these are the kind of things I'm looking for, or I don't want to be a gangster again. Stop sending me 35 gang. I get what you're trying to do here. Do you have to set the ground rules when it
comes
to...
You know pretty quickly when you read something, if you like it, you know? I do, at least. I also know quickly if you don't like something. So it isn't even so much that You know, I might get two gangster things, and they could be very different. Sort of like when I had played Rothstein on Boardwalk Empire for four seasons, and then they sent me Edward G. Robinson, for instance, who was known as being an actor in gangster films in his youth. I was sort of like, oh, God, you know, do I want to go down this road? Plus, he's really famous, and he's even more famous than Rothstein. And, you know, what do you do? What do you do? But the challenge was too exciting to pass up, and the cast was extraordinary. Jay Roach is like the nicest man in the world. So to get to learn about him, that's really what gets me, is I want to learn about this stuff. I want to try. And I might fall on my face, and I have over and over and over again, but it shouldn't stop you from wanting to try. And if someone offers you a gig, jump at it, and that's what I've done. But like I sort of alluded to before, you don't get a lot of opportunity to select what comes your way. You know, I think of it kind of spiritually or karmically as sort of like, I don't know if I'm meant to do this stuff, but I'm glad things have come my way, and I'm glad to give it a shot.
The life of an actor is one that a lot of people who are listening who may not know that life or think that it's all glitter and, and, you know, someone's tending to your pool. There's a lot of rejection in this business, and there's a lot of growing and having to pick yourself back up.
It isn't even so much the rejection that bothers me, honestly, because if somebody doesn't want to work with me, that's fine. Some of the hard things about it are, for me, the waiting to find out if you've got a gig, the waiting for an audition, the waiting while you're on set, waiting to, you know, for them to get the light right, or maybe they have to rearrange the scene so that something you shot, you think you were going to shoot at 6 in the morning, ends up being shot at 6 in the morning the next day, and you've been on set for 12, 14, 17 hours or whatever the heck it is. It's just a challenging craft because they need you ready when they are ready, not when you are ready. With the theater, you know it's 8 o'clock at night or, you know, a 2 o'clock matinee, and you can gear your whole day around being ready for those 2 or 3
hours.
How
do you mentally prepare for that?
You don't.
As an actor, you don't.
You basically, you know your lines, you know what you want to do, and you show.
You hope the trailer's clean.
Yeah, and you take care of yourself. That's, I think, finding balance in your life. People often say find a good hobby. Sure, that helps. Or to keep yourself just engaged somehow. You talk to each other. You read. You do your hobbies, whatever they happen to be, until you get powerful enough, I guess, to be in a situation where when you show up, they will be ready when you show up, as opposed to you being ready when they show up.
Closer to that. You know, you mentioned the idea of whether this is karma and this is what you were meant to do in your life. Can you see yourself at this stage of your life, or even, you know, in the next 10 years, shifting out of being an actor? Saying, you know what, that was great, I love that. Can you imagine a world in which you're not acting?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yes and no. I love what I do. I love to have the opportunities to do what I do. I try to invest a big part of myself in everything that I do, so sometimes it can be exhausting, time-consuming, and depleting. Yet at the same time, I just want to give the best performance that I can with every opportunity that's given to me. You know, if I'm not acting, I'd be interested in writing. If I'm not writing, it would be directing. If it wasn't directing, it would be painting or drawing. I love the engagement and the collaboration of art in general, whether it's creating films or creating theater or creating paintings. Or I love the dialogue, and I love the creativity, and I love sharing ideas with people and learning things. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to have fallen in my life that I've been able to express myself and to collaborate with such wonderful artists thus far, and I hope to continue to do it, but it's hard. The work is hard. I mean, it's not as hard as other jobs, but the focus you need to do good work can be exhausting. Yet at the same time, it depends where you're coming from. Right. And if you've taken care of yourself, I love the work. And honestly, any opportunity to do it would be great. Saying goodbye to it would be difficult in any form, because it's become a part of, I guess, my identity at this point.
I'll think of a fancier way to ask the question, what's next? But, you know, for actors and especially successful actors, like film actors like yourself, the name of the game is to line up the next project and the next project and the next project. You have to have that mental discipline to think a year out on your life.
Yeah, if you're lucky to be able to be a part of those decisions.
Are that what you have to do right now as someone who's had success is to look ahead and stack these projects?
If you're lucky enough to have those opportunities, sure. For me, it hasn't really worked out that way. I tend to find out about something while I'm in the middle of something else. So if it's something I want to do, I'll do everything I can to make it work. And the folks that work with me do their best to help me out to make those things happen. Sometimes you can plan ahead and sometimes you can't. If you're making your own work, you can ideally set time aside to do that. But it's kind of, as we suggested, you know, what comes down the pike. You make the best decisions you can and you put your best face forward.
And you do it with passion.
Yeah.
Michael Stuhlbarg is the star of the film Call Me By Your Name, the indie, which is out in select theaters now after a great showing at the film festivals. Michael Stuhlbarg, pleasure to have you at the big table tonight. I really appreciate
you
talking.
Thank you very much.
Great to have Michael Stuhlbarg in studio, huh? That dude's so good. I'm trying to convince my wife to go back and watch the full four seasons of Boardwalk Empire. Show on HBO, gangster show from the 20s or 30s, Jersey, New York, or Atlantic City. I don't know. I watched an episode for this interview, for the Stuhlbarg interview, and I wanted to better understand his character. That's great.
Yeah.
I really dug it. I was like, this is good. But I can't get her to start like a four episode.
It's hard.
It's hard.
Because it's an hour. It's, you know, it's a solid hour. Yeah. And you're intimidated because you got four seasons.
Mm-hmm. No one Geico commercial that they play every time there's a commercial break on your on demand. All right. We get it. There needs to be a commercial here. You only have one. You're going to play it over and over and over for the 1 hour show. No, none of that. HBO. They go full 59 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I want to see. Maybe I'll just start watching it myself. I hate to do that because then there's nothing to share. You can't share. You know, if I could do that, I could wake up in the morning. You know, I don't come into work till early afternoon. So I could, you know, get a nice little 10 a.m. Boardwalk Empire marathon going.
Yeah, why not?
Because then I get to season one going, is anybody watching? And everyone will be like, no, we're not watching. Because that was a show from 5 years ago.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite Facebook posts about old TV. Like, you know, I just saw somebody posting about Breaking Bad. You know, season 4, episode 9, it was the first bad Breaking Bad. I'm like, okay.
All right. I know. I'm excited. I like the, you know, the Golden Globe nominations are out. And I like it because ultimately, they will give me ideas of what to watch that I missed.
Yeah, right.
You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And I was looking at the television, you know, nominations for the Golden Globe. And it had Master of None, and I think it had. But the Golden Globes always do the weird thing where they put stuff on that no one else recognizes as award winning, like CBS sitcoms and stuff. And I'm not putting down Big Bang Theory or Mom or any of that stuff that's on there, but it doesn't usually rise to the level of what the media considers to be darlings.
Right.
You know, that you'll see in the Emmy category or something like that.
And
then ultimately they win at the Golden Globes. So there's a strange, like, or it's like a brand new show that nobody knows because it had, you know, it came from Europe first. And the voters all knew it because it's the foreign correspondents and, you know what I mean? And you're like, I have no... And then you start to watch it. You're like, oh, I'll watch the Golden Globe winner. And you're like, nah. I think the Golden Globe winner is ridiculous.
Yeah. Like that one about the orchestra.
Yeah.
That won a couple of years ago. I remember we watched it. I'm like, this is okay. It's fine.
Okay.
Why am I wasted? I can't remember what it was. I can't even remember what it was called.
Well, I went online today because I wanted to see what Netflix shows were coming out in January. And I couldn't find the list. Instead, what they do is by quarter. You know, they say the first quarter of 2018, you'll see Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, season 4. You'll see season 2 of Series of Unfortunate Events. There's a couple other, Love, Paul Rust, who was on the show.
Oh, yeah.
That's coming back. But they don't give a date. Instead, they just say sometime in the first quarter of 2018. And I think that's weird because I'm like, all right, just tell me when. Like, I want it January. I don't want first quarter. It'd be first month. Coming up first quarter. What are you, a corporation?
Yeah, I know.
We're waiting for your returns? All right, coming up, 9 o'clock hour, as advertised, we're going to talk about Harry Potter, Potted Potter, which is at the Chicago Playhouse over at Water Tower, coming in for a run. They boast they can put 7 Harry Potter books into a 70-minute parody. They break it all down, and almost in rapid fire, these two actors incredibly perform the entire Harry Potter series. It is, it's a long-running smash hit. It's ran in the West End in London for years. It's run in New York. It's also been on tour. It's the third time coming to Chicago. So we'll talk with the guys behind that show, the creators. They're actually on stage right now wrapping up, and they'll be here over at 9:30. And also coming up tonight, a return engagement. We welcome back Ashley Brown, Broadway star, such Broadway musicals like Mary Poppins and Beauty and the Beast. She's going to be back for the Merry Merry Chicago show, which is at the Chicago Symphony Center, which starts this weekend, runs for about a week. It's eight days, I think, till 23rd. Great. We're at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and the Chicago Children's Choir, and Ashley Brown get up on stage and perform some of the great classic Christmas songs. You'd love it, Pete. I don't know how that's not on your list.
It should be on my list.
It should be on your list.
Well, let's see what she says. Maybe convince me.
Convince me.
A lot of pressure on a Broadway star.
You've got a Christmatologist behind you, Ashley. I just want to let you know he's judging you at every turn. All right, so all that coming up at 9. And in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, Greg Flamm is back with the swap meet. Well, we will evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. It's a download. Stay with us.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with string. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudel, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wing. These are a few of my favorite things.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, expect music like this, because the best way to say it. Ashley Brown, a Broadway star who was Mary Poppins in the Mary Poppins Broadway musical back in 2006. Also, Belle and Beauty and the Beast will be in town starting on Friday at Merry Merry Chicago, her second time through at the Symphony Center for the big holiday program that includes members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Chicago Children's Choir. Ashley Brown, second time through to this program. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me back.
So I love that. I mean, we talked last year at this time. It's funny because the dates are almost identical, the same days. But
deja
I mean,
vu.
It is something that is becoming a tradition for you. Why come back? Why continue to do Merry Merry Chicago?
You know, I love, 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 love Chicago. And I just had the best time last year doing this concert. The audiences are amazing and people bring their families and everybody's celebrating the holidays. And, it's just in this orchestra. I'm lucky enough to go all over the world to sing with orchestras, and they're one of the best. And I just love it.
You know, there's a difference, and we talked about it last year, but there's a big difference between singing to orchestra when you're in a Broadway musical and singing with an orchestra on stage.
Absolutely.
And you've carved out a niche in the way that you are continuing your career in singing with orchestras on stage. Talk mm-hmm. about that difference and what you have to do to approach that as a professional.
There's a huge difference, and one of my favorite differences is, you know, when you're singing with a symphony, you are making music with those musicians. Music is happening in front of you together. On Broadway, you know, they're in the pit and you very rarely get to see who is playing for you. And you're not, I mean, it's just a different muscle. You're trying to create basically the same show every night, and you have right. to keep within the guidelines. And here, you know, you're on stage with them, so you feel them, you feel each other breathing. And it's just more just in the moment.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it, is if I hold a note a little longer, Emil, the maestro, follows me. And everybody's just kind of finding their own way. And there's different solos. It's not just me. It's more of a group effort. That's how I view it. I know I'm standing in front, but at the same time, I try to feel it's just more of a group effort.
You know, you don't think about that, but the pursuit of theater, especially mm-hmm. when it comes to Broadway, is to be as consistent as possible every single night. When you're doing 8 shows a week,
yeah,
the idea really is to put out a consistent product, a flawless, consistent product every single night. That's
exactly.
because it's the first time someone's going to see it.
Yeah.
And there really isn't a lot of room for improvisation because everybody has to hit their part at the right
exactly.
part.
Exactly. Right? And there's so many technical aspects to Broadway, too. It's like if I were to hold note a little longer, or the orchestra doesn't have that same note, and maybe stage management has a cue on that exact word, and if I don't say the word at that time, everything trickles down, you know. I mean, there's a little freedom with the dialogue,
right,
and you
right.
want to stay in the moment, but at the same time, it's more strict.
When you're playing in a setting like Orchestra Hall with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, how much do you have to be on the same page with those musicians? Because you're coming in, you know, you come in for the run.
Mm-hmm.
Rehearsal time is limited because they have the other gigs.
2 hours.
And, you know, they have, right.
2.5 hours.
So what do you do in those 2.5 hours to get on the same page for the review or the music that you're going to perform this week?
I come in as prepared as possible, that if I had to get out there and sing a cappella, I could. Not that that would ever happen, but I just come in very prepared. They get to look at their music. I don't. But at the same time, they are top-of-the-line musicians, and they come in and can read music and have practiced. And so it's just kind of – then we have the time to combine, where if I'm really prepared, they are really prepared, then we can make music. And we just kind of run through the songs, and when we hit a speed bump, we stop, we work it out, and we go do it again. But like, that's what's really exciting, is people assume we've rehearsed for weeks and weeks
right.
and weeks, and it's 2.5 hours. And that's why it's all about listening to each other. And the visual I like to use when singing with symphony is they're on a train, and you see this train coming at you because, you know, it's like 70 plus pieces and I'm one person. I'm not
right.
going to win. And my visual is the train's coming. So either you jump on the train and go with them, or you get hit by the train.
It's a very
I like
strong
to be
visual.
On the train.
Yeah.
Yes. I like to be on the train with them. Just riding in the front.
Ashley Brown in studio with she's going to be the guest vocalist for Mary Mary Chicago, which is going to be at Orchestra Hall coming up starting on Friday and
mm-hmm.
running through the 23rd. Tickets at CSO.org. What comes first for you? Does musical theater come first and get you prepared to work with ensemble and orchestra? Or is it something else? I mean, did you learn to sing in ensemble or sing with a orchestra before you got to the stage?
No, I never. Well, actually, I take that back. I was part of Pensacola. I'm from Pensacola, Florida. Well, Gulf Breeze, Florida. It's a small town next to Pensacola. And I was part of the Pensacola Children's Chorus from fourth grade all the way through high school. And we were very similar to the Chicago Children's Choir, where we had the opportunity of singing with our local symphony and as a choir and kind of doing it that way. But professionally, I didn't sing with my first symphony until after I had done a lot of Broadway shows. I knew it was something I always wanted to do because I love music and I love to sing. But so it's kind of a skill I learned growing up, but never as a soloist like I know now. But it's a different beast. I remember the first time I did it, just hearing, you know, because it's such a big orchestra, like learning, like for me now when I look at music, I'm like, oh, the violin's giving my cue. The flute gives me my cue. It's not just piano or the harp. Oh, and you have to like, I have to track it out. Like, oh, who gives me my downbeat at that certain measure? Or
I can't even imagine.
I know. It's like, I try to make it look like I'm just singing.
Yeah, just looked for whatever musician's doing the head nod. And now. And you're like, now I start singing.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Because, you know, your experience in being in that choir in Pensacola, or in Gulf Breeze, you said.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of being in a children's choir, how much did that help you in following your dream to Broadway? I mean, to having that discipline at such a young age.
Oh, I mean, it gave me my platform. Not to mention, still to this day, the best friends I've ever had. And because it's, even if you're not, I mean, I'm the only one that went on to, a lot of people have been successful that were in choirs, a lot of TV and film and blah, but going on to Broadway, even if you don't do anything in that field, it just teaches you so much. It teaches you discipline. It shows you how to show up to something and to be a part of something, to work in a group setting, to listen, to all those things that kids need to know. And I definitely think, and it taught me everything. It gave me my love of music, honestly. I'm the youngest of four. Nobody in my family is musical, like, at all. And I was horrible at sports. My siblings were really good, and I always kind of felt left out. And I'm like, oh, gosh, what's going to be my thing, you know? And I remember being in children's chorus, and I remember singing that first note and be like, this is it, honey. And I just loved it. It gave me my, like, outlet to do something. And I was actually, and I'm like, and I'm kind of good at it? This is awesome. And I just, I loved it. And I loved performing and, you know, my parents always say they wish I came with an instruction booklet because I was kind of like, hello, world. What do you have for me? Yes, I did that with jazz hands, everybody. And so I just, that's why I love singing with the Chicago Children's Choir, because I look at them in their little uniforms and just singing Christmas songs. And it just, I hope they know how important this time is.
Broadway star Ashley Brown in studio tonight. She is going to be the guest vocalist at Merry Merry Chicago, which is the holiday program, one of the holiday programs at Orchestra Hall for Chicago Symphony Center. Members of the CSO, also the Chicago Children's Choir, will be there. It runs through the 15th to the 23rd. Let's do this. We'll take a quick break, come back, and we'll talk about Christmas songs.
Great.
Ashley Brown, stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Ashley Brown in studio tonight. She is the guest vocalist for Merry Merry Chicago, which is at the Chicago Symphony Center, starting on the 15th, running to the 23rd. Merry Merry Chicago becoming a tradition down at Orchestra Hall. Members of the CSO perform, as well as the Chicago Children's Choir, performing holiday classics, if you will. Ashley, you know, it's amazing to think that you've had such success on Broadway performing such iconic shows and music like Beauty and the Beast or even Mary Poppins. But, I mean, this is Christmas music. There are Christmas carols and songs. Talk about your draw. What draws you into coming back to do Merry Merry Chicago again?
You know, I love the freedom that they give me with my arrangements. You know, so I, when I do bring my arrangements, like my Christmas arrangements, what I love to do is, everybody does want to hear their favorites and their classics, but with my arrangements, I try to make them a little different. Not take away the melody or the right. song that anybody knows, because I hate when people do that. And you're like, what song is that? but I do try to really make them my own, where it's not just Jingle Bells and not just Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It just, whether it's still the song, but just the orchestration's a little different, and the interludes are a little different, and the melody, there's some key changes, and just kind of make it fun so the audience actually listens again versus, like, sings along.
Right, right.
You know?
If, for you, I mean, how much input do you have on the selections, the songs that are going to be performed in Merry Merry Chicago?
A lot. You know, I really try to be as much of a part of programming as possible with all of my shows, whether Christmas, Broadway, no matter what time of year I'm singing. Because I really, I love, you know, being able to build a show. And what I love with Emile Ducoux, I was able to, our maestro, is we really have been emailing back and forth for probably a year, being like, what can we do to make this evening really, really special? And so he's like, these are the charts, these songs I want to do, and here's this. And I was like, these are the songs I want to do. And we really just put together something really cool and work together. And it makes it so much more fun that
right,
way.
Right. For you, what's a Christmas classic that you have to do in a show?
Well, O Holy Night, I love doing, and I also love doing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Those are my two go-tos. O Holy Night was my very first solo in church when I was about 7. I did not have a 70-piece orchestra, but it just, and so it always brings me back. And whenever I'm home for Christmas in Florida, I still go back to my little church in Gulf Breeze and sing it with my pianist.
You do?
Yeah. And everybody's like, really? You sing every day? And I said, I love it. It's the same walls, and the Johnsons still sit on pew 2, and like, it's the same view, except just everybody's older, you know. But it's, and so I love doing that because it reminds me where it all started. And so that's why those are my go-to.
Well, those songs and a lot of the Christmas fare, they do that. There's something about tradition, and there's something about memories and where you heard this song, where you performed this song. And as you just mentioned, going back to your home church to be able to sing the same song you did when you were 7.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something special in the way that this music extracts emotion from
us. It's so true. It always, there's something about you know, all the holidays, but especially Christmas, that it makes you think about the past and be thankful for it and thankful for the people you have in your life. And it's with this, the world, it's so chaotic all the time. And I think it's really hard to find those moments. And that's why I'm really excited about these concerts, is I think there's tons of moments here where people are going to find such peace and just have that moment of silence wherever they're just in the most beautiful concert hall, listening to the most beautiful symphony with these beautiful kids. And I just, it's going to be really special.
You know, the Ashley Browning Studio, you can get tickets for Mary Mary Chicago at CSO.org. This is Mary Mary Chicago, which is the 15th through the 23rd. And it also features members of the CSO as well as of the children's choir, Chicago Children's Choir. Working with kids and mm-hmm. working alongside choirs, I mean, you have that experience in your life, as you mentioned in this interview before. But, I mean, how does that add to the challenge of making sure everybody's on the same page in such a short amount of time?
Well, they come prepared. They come so prepared. There's sometimes I'm like, I better be really. They are so amazing. I sung with them last year as well, and they're fantastic and give me so much energy. It's such a gift. We sing together for the finale of the show, and it's this really great holiday hits medley. I don't want to give too much away, but it is so much fun. Dolly Parton might be involved. And so the kids just sing, and I'm just so excited. It's going to be really fun.
All right. So, you know, as we wrap up here, I'm interested in, you know, this kind of performance that you do, because you do the Christmas shows and you also do Broadway mm-hmm. selections, and you perform with symphonies around the country and around the world. But talk about that. I mean, because you, and we talked about this last time, we didn't spend a lot of time on your Broadway career, but you have done the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
And now you find yourself in this, in what is considered almost like rotation in the way that you're performing with all these symphonies. Is this the direction you want to go with your career? I mean, can you do both?
I definitely can do both. I'm a mom now, and I'm just very picky. And I love the concert because I can go out and be Ashley. I can go out and sing like me and just dress like me and all those kind of things. And it gives me a great balance of being able to be a mom and to be able to still do what I love to do, because I am absolutely want to show my daughter that she can do anything she wants to do and that mom is doing exactly what she wants to do, you know. Happy wife, happy life, you know, as they say. And I definitely want to be back on Broadway. It's my dream. It's all of this is my dream, honestly. But I want it to be the right show. 8 shows a week is a really, really tough schedule. And so it has to be something my heart is 100% in. I've done it, and it's very hard.
And I
have never done it with a kid.
It's an industry, and we've talked about this a lot in this program, that a lot of people, what you see on the surface level, when you see the marquees and the people in the show, that's just the tip of the iceberg underneath all mm-hmm. the workshops, the creative, the projects that don't go anywhere. So even finding a script and a show that you want to attach yourself to because you feel passionate about doesn't necessarily mean it's going to make it to the marquee in months.
Exactly. And that's where our business is very hard. But I feel so fortunate that I have the option to go back or to stay with a concert. And even if I get another Broadway show, I would still be concerting because I love it. Like, I would, you know, take some weekends off from the show and just make sure I'm still able to go and do that, because it's important to me. And I love playing a character. I love it. And I love performing in New York and being on Broadway. It's like I came out of the womb wanting to do that. But I've also found this really great love for symphony, singing with symphonies as well.
Ashley Brown will be singing with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra as well as the Chicago Children's Choir starting on Friday, running through the 23rd. It's Mary Mary Chicago, the third year that the Chicago Symphony Center is taking this on. Ashley's second year being the guest vocalist. Like I said, you can find tickets at CSO.org. Ashley, great to see you, and congrats, and good luck with the run.
Thank you so much.
It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, Greg Flamm back in the building with the swap meet. It's, of course, where we evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. 312-981-7200 every Wednesday. Greg in the building. So that's coming up 10 o'clock. So get yourself ready for that. Get up to the attic, the basement, the garage, wherever your junk is at. see if it's worth anything tonight. Well, this week, Chicago welcomes back the Smash West End and New York comedy Potted Potter, the Unauthorized Harry Experience. It's a parody created by Dan Clarkson and Jefferson Turner. The duo Dan and Jeff created this show first as a street performance that morphed into a stage show and now into one of the more popular touring shows around the world. The show crams all 7 Harry Potter books into 70 minutes. The show's been around for the better part of a decade, and the creators are still doing the heavy lifting. Of course, Harry Potter continues to be one of the biggest series of books in literature history, and a new play is set to hit Broadway in the spring. And one of the great things about this show is that every year a new generation of readers are introduced to the world of Harry Potter, which means more audience. Potted Potter is on stage at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower through January 21st, already extended. And it's my pleasure to welcome Dan and Jeff to the Download. Guys, thanks for being here.
Good evening. Thank you.
Welcome back to Chicago. Welcome back to Chicago. It's your third time coming through.
You know, when
you guys obviously do so many different cities and you, like I said, do most of the heavy lifting, do you get a chance to spend some time in the city or is it pretty much you do the show and you're out?
No, we do. Our first time here, we were here for about a month. So, yeah, we had plenty of time to check everything out. We both completely fell in love with Chicago. And it's been a long time since we've been able to come back. So
yeah, and this is our favorite city, and we don't say that everywhere.
No, just here, right.
Why it's our third time back. The great thing about creating a show is you can go, yeah, I really want to go to these places. Yeah. It's like, Chicago again, let's keep coming back here.
Do you notice a difference between the different cities from around the country or in Canada or even in Europe and Britain when it comes to the reaction to the show?
Yeah, we definitely have favorites, and some are harder to get a reaction from the audience, and Chicago's fantastic. I mean, obviously it sounds like I'm saying that because I'd say it anywhere, but it really is. The audiences are not shy in letting us know when they're enjoying it, so that's nice. Big laughs.
I love the origin story of this performance because it starts as a street I know, right? It's fine, you can make up all you want, but I mean it starts as a street performance, really in a way to celebrate what, the sixth or seventh book that's being launched, but idea that essentially you made up a skit, if you will, outside of a line of people getting ready to buy
it
something.
Literally was I think it was midnight for a London bookstore, and a friend of mine who was for a PR company knew we did silly things like this and went, hey, let's do Harry Potter, and we're like, yeah, that'll be fun. And so we were stood on the street at midnight in London entertaining this queue, and it turns out Harry Potter was quite popular. Who knew? And so by the end of it, we're going, okay, this could be something. And I think it was only 15 minutes originally that we did all 5 books, and then we took it to Edinburgh that year with only 6 books in it, and I think it was 60 minutes, and now we're 70 minutes, so we've given ourselves a little bit more time because we're getting older.
Good, yeah.
Now.
You know. Yeah. We creak a bit now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, take us back to, you know, when you get that feel, when that emotion, riding that high, that you're on to something. Obviously, Harry Potter, even when you're starting a better part of it 12 years, 11 years ago, was a huge phenomenon, even at that point. When you went to Edinburgh and you went to the Fringe and you put this performance on stage, not just, you know, to the queue that's outside the bookstore, could you feel the excitement? You could feel what people were responding to it?
I guess this is the type of thing that you think you're funny, as we all do, and your mum tells you you're funny, but it's that first time going, will anyone else find this funny? Are we just going to have this room of silence as we come out going, hey, we're Harry Potter?
Right, like, right.
What are you guys doing? But the feel, and I think always with Harry Potter, the energy that you get from the audience, because we're coming from a place of love and it's real homage and we're geeky fans ourselves, and you get the fans coming to see it and you have this sense of it's for all of us and we're enjoying this and we're
it's community.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And so the excitement in the room is there as soon as you come on stage. So, you know, I mean, I've got to give some credit to J.K. Rowling. She came up with a good idea.
Right, right, really. Right.
Yeah. And that first year in Edinburgh, we were in a room, 60-seater. So it was a small room and it was incredibly intimate. And so you really could hear every laugh and every lack of a laugh.
Yeah.
So it was a baptism of fire as well. We fine-tuned the show that year quickly.
To piggyback on the idea of parody, I mean, because it can come from two different places. It can come from love or it can come from hate. And then you'll see that in the best parodies we have. A lot of sketch shows and others will do a lot where they're really kind of making fun of the issue by parodying it. In this case, the parody comes from a place of love.
Yeah, if we'd come at it from the other way, we wouldn't exist anymore. The fans, Harry Potter fans, are something else. They wouldn't stand for it. If they thought we were on stage being cynical and literally making fun of the show, that we'd be booed off, we'd be thrown out of the city.
And I think for us, because you do it so many times, you have to love your material and you have to enjoy your material. This is why we've never done Twilight. Because they're awful books. but that's why. So, I mean, all the shows we've done have always come from a place of love, and that's how we've picked our subject matter. And we did initially adore the books. And that's, I think that's why we took the job on the street, was just to get to the book before the queue got to the book. I remember pushing children out the way going, excuse me, I'm very important. I want to read this before you.
That sounds like a joke. He really did do that.
Yeah, yeah. And now 10 years on, these children are bigger than me.
They're coming back for revenge. Well, it is, I mean, there's a long-standing tradition of parody in the UK. I mean, I know from my experience of going to the Edinburgh Fringe how many shows were at the Fringe Festival that had parody as at the center or the core of what they were doing. Where does that come from for you guys? I mean, are you guys, because you guys have had a lot of other projects beyond just Harry Potter, but talk about the art of the parody and being able to put that forward as a piece of art.
I think it, certainly in Britain, I know it's true of other countries as well, but certainly in Britain, we're big fans of poking fun at things we love. If someone, like sports teams or TV programs or singers that we like, it's fun to make fun of them because you're showing that you have a knowledge of it and you're showing that you're secure in your loving of that thing.
So, and as British, we're bad at everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you know, we came second in the War of Independence. You know, we messed that one up. I mean, we're just awful. So we have to be able to laugh at ourselves.
Right, right. But there's an art to it. I mean, there's great parodies we've seen. There's also mediocre to awful parodies, and we see that come out a lot as well. But you guys have been able to extend this show and have monster success off of essentially poking fun at and from a place of love. Mm. This amazing piece or pieces of literature.
Absolutely. And I think the joy is, as you've said, is that there are new people coming to these books every day, which I find amazing. I also kind of hate them because we had to wait years for these books to come out. You know, the children will never understand that I had to wait 2 years between books 4 and 5 to get that next book. And they're like, no, I've got them all. I'm using my mum's copy.
Was that your impression of a child?
That was my impression of a millennial child. I can read all the books whenever I want. That's what they sound like.
In studio, the duo Dan and Jeff, Dan Clarkson and Jefferson Turner. They are the creative minds, the writers and performers of Potted Potter, the unauthorized Harry experience, 7 Harry Potter books in 70 minutes. It's at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower, running through January 21st. It opens on Friday, is that right?
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Tomorrow night. Dan and
You're
Jeff.
You're coming.
Yeah, I know. But I didn't know if the opening was like the day after the press.
You thought we were just doing it for you
tomorrow?
I thought
it was just me. Yeah. No, it's not happening.
Oh, no, we're going to disappoint you now.
There are other people there? Yeah. That's no fun.
We would have just come to your house in that case. Just done in your front room.
Plenty, we could do that too. Yeah. Dan and Jeff, my guests, let's take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, the creators, writers, and performers of Potted Potter, the unauthorized Harry experience, cramming all 7 Harry Potter books into 70 minutes on stage at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower through January 21st, opens tomorrow. In studio, Dan Clarkson and Jefferson Turner. They are the duo Dan and Jeff. This show is, 11 years old? I mean, it's 2006-ish. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing to me that the show... it's not amazing that it was a success, but it's amazing that I know, right?
How?
I mean,
when you say that,
please. But the fact that you can continue to do it, and we kind of mentioned this before, this idea of new fans, that you can continue to make it fresh and new because the fans of Harry Potter are fresh and new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, at the time, it was like Beatlemania for books, wasn't it? There was nothing ever like this before. I mean, the fact that we were saying earlier we performed this at a bookshop. This is a bookshop at midnight that was just rammed with people screaming and going crazy. And, I mean, it was closest we ever felt to rock stars.
Cause... Yeah, that first time in 2005 in the bookstore, we were expecting 100 people in the queue, maybe. And it was over 1,000 when we finally did the show at midnight. We were shouting ourselves hoarse. And the reaction we got back from them, we were going, oh, maybe there is something in this. You know, so maybe people do like Harry Potter.
And I think they're now parents, because if you started reading the books, they came out, what, we're nearly 20 years
ago? Yeah, yeah.
So right. Then your parents are now going, oh, I read these as a kid, and now I can pass them to my
kid. Grandmothers. My son is 10 years old, he's reading them, and he's getting his books from his grandparents.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's almost like the sort of Star Wars phenomenon that it's, and I love Star Wars too, because I'm a geek. and it's great that that's now coming back, and it's just like, there's almost this nostalgia now attached to Harry Potter, which is then making it even more popular. And
I think Harry Potter was, well, certainly the first series of books that I knew that were aimed at kids, but it was completely cool for adults to be reading. We'd have on the London Underground, you'd see grown adults sat without a care in the world reading the first Harry Potter book. And, you know, you wouldn't have seen that before. You know, people would be a bit self-conscious. Yeah. And then the adult covers were made. They didn't look so much like kids' books. And so that was one of the great joys. Whatever age you were, you could enjoy the books.
I mean, this is a great British product, right? I mean, this is what
we had to have one.
Yeah. The other one, just one. But
and James Bond, that's what we've got. Yeah.
But it's amazing to me because in Chicago, there's fandom goes crazy for Harry Potter in the States. But going back to England, I mean, is it bigger? Is the loyalty stronger for Harry Potter in its origin country?
I mean, I'd love to say yes, because, you know, we're British and we like to claim ownership. But it's like going, well, the British office is better than the American office, isn't it? But, I mean, it's not true. Like, you guys...
In that case, it is.
Yeah. You just do it bigger and better. Right. And, I mean, we were unsure when we first came here what the reaction would be. But the fans are just... I mean, they're incredible out here. And there's a level which we've never seen in the UK. Like, someone will wear a T-shirt in the UK and go, look, I like Harry Potter. Here, they'll come in full Dumbledore robes with a beard and the hat. And that's women. Yeah. And it's just like... Wow, you guys are awesome!
Yeah,
with this.
You guys aren't backwards and coming forwards.
No.
Whereas in England, there's still a bit reserved and still keep it a bit under our hats. But here, if you like something, you shout about it, and that's a good way to be.
Are the audiences different? I mean, when you're doing this show, is there do you have to be more sophisticated with a British audience because
this is our home? Yeah, right. Yes, because we all went to Oxford, and we're very well trained.
But because it's their home, it's the home of the product.
Yeah, I think the best analogy, I think, is we've got cricket to your baseball, and you go to a cricket match and everyone's very polite and we clap if somebody gets a wicket and we go, oh, well done.
And we stop for tea.
Yeah, where you go to baseball and it's this party and everyone's on their feet and cheering. And it's exactly the same because we play Quidditch in the show and the British audiences, they're nice. And they're going, yes, this is fun. We're playing Quidditch. Good. American, you guys take it to this new level of, I mean, I've seen dads push children who aren't their own out the way to get this ball into this hoop. I mean, you guys are out for blood and it's amazing to watch.
It's great to see a grown man stand up. You can see his vision is clouding and all of a sudden it's the Super Bowl and this ball's coming towards him. It's like, this is it. This is what my life's been building up to.
And then that look he gets from his wife as he sits back down going, didn't I do much? Like, no.
The show, as you talk about it's the unauthorized Harry experience. Have you had any experience with J.K. Rowling or the Harry Potter empire that says, let's slow your roll on this, on this parody?
Lovely. I mean, I think because they know it comes from a place of love and, you know, they are aware of us and we've always talked with them. And we did get to meet J.K. Rowling and I didn't get starstruck easy, but she knew who we were. Yeah. And someone said, these are the Potted Potter guys. And she went, oh, you must be Dan. I was like, I'm Dan. And Jeff was giggling like a little girl. Going, yeah. He's like, right. So how's your show going? I'm Dan. And then that was it. She was like, OK, right, good. Well, lovely to meet you guys. Take care. And that was our big moment. But she was just, incredible.
I'm sure it was as memorable for her.
Yeah. I don't think she was walking on the ground. I felt she just floated into the room, just like, oh.
You know, the style of show, and I've only seen clips of it, and I'm going to go see it this week, but, you know, it is tomorrow.
Like, I feel tomorrow. I need to keep reminding you.
Keep reminding me because I will miss it. Yeah. But, I mean, there's obviously the idea of 70 minutes or 7 books in 70 minutes, the pace has to keep going. But by design and what you guys do, you can almost feel the streak performance out of it. The idea that the energy is playing to this massive audience that may not necessarily just be someone who sits in a theater seat. Is that the design of the show?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's breaking the fourth wall, then there's taking a sledgehammer and we smash it out the way. And we've often said the audience is the third member of the cast. And I mean, that doesn't mean if you're one of these people sitting there going, but I don't want to join in. That's cool. You don't have to. We encourage if you want to shout out, if you want to, I mean, we have a lot of heckles, and especially... children's heckling, I think, is the best in the
very
world.
Very honest.
Yeah, because our minds work from like A to B to C, where a child will go from A to G to F to Z and just shout out some of the most inane things. You're like, brilliant, let's do this for a while. Okay, this is where the show's going tonight.
Because we really aimed for it to be a family show. We really wanted sort of everything from six up, everyone to get something from the show, to enjoy the show. You can't expect the entire audience to sit still the entire time, because that might be great for a 55-year-old, but a 7-year-old, you know, sit in a seat without moving for 70 minutes, that's asking quite a lot. So it was important, that, as Dan said, for them to be the third member of the show.
Is it hard for you guys? I mean, your background, your children's programming at BBC, you've done a lot of different things. Is there an art to being a family-friendly show? Is there something as comedians, as parody artists?
I think I'm going to blow my own trumpet now. I think it's tougher because you can't curse, is one thing. I think a lot of go-to, and when I've written adult comedy, a lot of go-tos go, right, well, if I just write that word, that'll get the laugh. Whereas this, you've got to be clever and go, well, how can we achieve that same laugh or same moment, and how? And you find yourself going down surreal routes, which is often the result is better.
Yeah.
I think, hope so.
No, that's what I was going to say. You actually end up with a funnier gag, because you've had to think about it more. At the time, it's a bit of a pain, but if you take the time to think of a non-rude way to get where you want to get, and it actually ends up as a better crafted joke.
But then you've always got that moment where you've spent ages crafting a joke and it gets an okay laugh, then you make a mistake and the crowd go on, you're like, brilliant. Right, so that's brilliant. All I had to do is trip up on the stage and that was it.
And you know, we're not too proud to keep that mistake in from then on. It got a laugh.
Yeah, we'll do it again.
When you think about this show, is which hat are you guys using more? Are you using the hat of someone who's had experience in children's programming, the hat of being fans of Harry Potter, or your comedy background, the background that has created this parody to begin with?
Can I say an all three hat? As it formed together in like a tricorn, if you will.
Tricorn, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Hamilton wears one of those. I hear that's a good show. I've been told I plug Hamilton more than our show. I'm just really excited it's here.
I think probably the comedy background is the one that comes off most, I'd have thought.
Yeah, and I think it's always important to, we aim high, so we never play down to kids. We never patronise the audience, so we go for the top level. And some things will go over the kids' heads, some things go over the adults' heads. I remember we made a joke once about Justin Bieber, and I saw this kid explain to his grandmother who that was, because she was like, I've no idea.
I don't know who that is,
sounds
right.
Lovely. And I'm sure she looked him up when she got home and went, oh, well, he's lovely, isn't he?
Well, now I'm a believer.
Yeah. As comedians, then, and being able to have such a successful show, besides the idea of maybe taking time off and letting other actors come in and stand in, how do you keep it fresh and exciting as two performers? I mean, the material is rapid fire, so there's not a lot of room in the piece to try new directions or improvise. So how do you keep it fresh and fun as the creators, the guys who wrote this thing?
Dan is not scared of changing something on the fly, and I've had to learn how to deal with that. And I think there's parts of the show that are structured and have to stay as they are for it to work, it to be funny. There's bits that are looser, and Dan will do something different every night. And I can tell early on whether he's feeling mischievous or not, whether he gives me an easy ride or not. But
and I think like any good parody, there's a lot of pop culture references. Mm-hmm. And if we were doing the same ones that we had 11 years ago, people have been... I mean, we used to have one about Rihanna's umbrella.
I knew you were gonna say that one.
Yeah, and if we still had that, and people go, really, guys? Really? You've still got this line
you're
in?
You're so with it.
Yeah. So that gets to change, and it's exciting to, you know... We may or may not mention a president of a country that...
Sure.
Possibly... We may or may not, you know, it's just...
And
you
he's the gift that keeps
judgmental.
On giving, isn't he? So there's always something you can mention.
All right, the show is Potted Potter, the Unauthorized Harry Experience. It's a parody, seven Harry Potter books crammed into 70 minutes. The show has been running a smash hit for over a better part of a decade, 11 years. Started as a street performance for a line queuing outside of a bookstore in London, and is now touring all around the world. And it's in Chicago through January 21st, opening tomorrow night at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower. BroadwayChicago.com is the website to get tickets. Dan and Jeff, my guests, Dan Clarkson, Jefferson Turner. Guys, thanks so much for coming in talking about
these. No, thank you.
So, appreciate it.
Cheers.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Great to have those guys, huh? Awesome. Do British parody all night. Talk about that show. I love it.
And it's the little things, like how he calls Z, Z.
There you go,
I love that.
Right?
From A to Z.
From A to Z. Love it. All right. So we will have it's fun to have those guys. And you can check them out at the Broadway Playhouse, Water Tower, through the 21st. Already got extended, Rob. How about that?
It's good stuff.
Didn't even start yet. And they have extended it.
Have you seen it?
I haven't. I'm going tomorrow.
Oh, well, you...
I know. I haven't. I'm doing a surprise. I have not told my son, who's super into Harry Potter. He's super into it. Like, he's got one more book to go. He bragged this week that he read 200 pages in a day. Like, he's a kid, and I hesitate, you know, because I don't want to give him a complex, but he's like, I read so many pages of the Harry Potter book at school today. I'm like, well, what was everybody else doing? Having fun? Everybody else is goofing around doing this, and you're like, I have to read the book. I didn't say that, but that's the vibe right away. I'm like, is there any social stuff going on? Is there anyone, like, you know, playing Madden on their thing? And you're like, I have to read my Harry Potter book.
Meanwhile, all the other parents are going, why aren't you reading?
Exactly. So, yeah, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. All right, Greg Flamm coming up here. Swap Meet, 312-981-7200.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
I have returned.
He has returned to the Wednesday Nights Swap Meet at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. This, of course, our segment that we do every Wednesday night, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. One of my favorite nights
always
of the week,
fun.
Because I get to see Greg and I get to hear from you, the download listener, about what you've collected, what you've kept for your entire life, and you're trying to see if it's worth anything or what you want to brag about.
Right.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I kept it pretty light today, seeing as how we were off of the last couple of weeks, so I was hoping we'd get a little bit more calls in. But I brought in some staples, you know, your Legos, your Hot Wheels, and one of these things is not like the other, an O.J. Simpson comic book.
An O.J. Simpson comic book when he was a running back? Did he like
do a comic book? These
fighting
are like
crime?
1995.
Causing crime?
Right.
Oh, yeah, look at
they're,
that.
They're 1995, so. And there's probably a handful of them.
It's
that
called
they
The
put
Glove
out.
Doesn't Fit?
Yeah, there's one that has the whole deal with that.
Really? Like a cartoon? or a comic book
that has the whole Brown family and everything on the cover. It's kind of weird. But the Hot Wheels are pretty cool. They were a series, the Beatles Yellow Submarine series, and I have all six here.
Wow.
Of the six sets, so that's kind of cool. And then this Lego set was kind of an exclusive, where if you bought a bigger Lego set, they were giving these free, so you really couldn't buy these in the store. So it's kind of an exclusive, like Toys R Us.
Does Lego, because they have exploded in the last couple of years with sets, and they've kind of gone away from blocks, so that's really what you're going to get in, if you go back to the 70s and 80s when it comes to Legos, it's just blocks. There's not these sets like they
right.
have now.
Right, and a ton more specialty pieces now than there were when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, I was looking online. I think it was a Harry Potter piece where I wanted to get the Harry Potter piece for my son for Christmas. And I was looking, and it was one that wasn't abnormally sized. It wasn't like the mansion or the Hogwarts. It was something.
But
and it was a ton of money because it's out of stock at this point, or it's not on the shelves.
Right.
So it was hundreds of dollars more than it was at face value.
Yeah, and just the figurine alone, like the Harry Potter figurine, I don't know what that specific one goes for, but almost any figurine is like $8 to $10
for the little guy.
Just a little figurine. It could be nothing, but if it's Star Wars or Harry Potter, it goes up from there.
Star Wars is another one because, you know, the new movie's coming out on Sunday.
Yep.
And I remembered, my wife reminded me of last time it came out, and I'll never forget this, that we had to scramble because it came out on December 18th or whatever.
Okay.
And the son goes and sees, 8 years old or whatever. He comes out of there and he's like, Kylo Ren this, Kylo Ren that. This is what I want for Christmas. And you're like, yeah.
And then you try to find it.
And
you
go running around Michigan Avenue trying to find a Kylo Ren lightsaber. But and my wife reminded, because we're done with Christmas shopping now. We're ready to go. We're ahead of the game, right?
Right.
But then she's like, you know, because we're going to go see the movie this weekend.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, man. So in a way, I'm going to be like trying to talk it down. not so much on this Kylo Ren this year.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere. I wouldn't want to wear his mask. The one that talks.
Yep. Well, you got to go to a couple stores and return some items and get the hot.
Did they put so much out for The Force Awakens, the last Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. They put so many toys and memorabilia, everything. Is that stuff at all starting to, is it ripen in any way when it comes to whether or not it's collectibles?
You know, the original three and the Kenner and 1977
that's
era
the only
stuff,
ones that count?
Well, I mean, that's like the, will always be the big money. Everything else kind of wavers. Like when, like now, almost everything Star Wars is kind of hot again because the movie's coming out. I mean, when I'm selling at Palatine, I hear people walking around, do you have any Star Wars yet? I mean, you can feel the buzz building when a movie's coming out for that. You know, they want anything Star Wars. But when it kind of then it's out 6-8 months, it's back to the 70s,
does
early
the,
80s.
Does the stuff that was for the prequels, like when they came out in the 2000s with all the Ewan McGregor kind of Star
right.
Wars. Is that stuff worth anything now? Are we too still kind of in no man's land?
I mean, some of it is, but it's still, again, the first
three.
Still
the 70s stuff, huh?
That always holds value, but the other stuff is as the movies are coming out, it kind of just ebbs and flows with new movie releases. And but
so
as a seller, I'm happy to accommodate people.
Any Star Wars toy that was made with lead.
Right.
That's worth something.
Yep.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. What do you want to brag about tonight? Do you want to talk Star Wars, Harry Potter? We could talk Lego sets as Greg
Whatever.
Has one in studio. We're here for you tonight. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kopp and Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. You can find them there. We're evaluating your junk, your collectibles, your memorabilia, the things that you pull down from the attic or the basement, or things you just want to brag about. 312-981-7200. Let's kick it off tonight with John. John, what do you want to brag about?
Well, I got a square cardboard record from Burger King, from Red Skelton, The Pledge of Allegiance.
What?
Wow.
So yes, it's just the Pledge of Allegiance?
The Pledge of Allegiance, as reviewed by Red Skelton from the Red Skelton Hour, January 14th, 1969.
Yes.
Wow. So he's just...
It's random. And it's not as rare as you think. I've looking up here, and they're going for really low, like $2 to $4.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
I would think that'd be at least 25 bucks.
But at least people are buying them. I mean, it looks like 7 have sold in the last month.
It's a square. It's like the old records that are squares.
Yes, it's a square. The circle that the needle plays on is blue and round.
Right.
But the actual record itself is cardboard and square.
Hmm. Yep. And the
from Burger King.
Did you get it from Burger King, or you just find it somewhere?
No. I've actually collected a lot of records from people just passing them down, people throwing them away. I've got a number of interesting things, and this just something that caught my eye.
Well, I would definitely pick that up at an estate sale if I saw, because as Justin knows, I'm a big collector of Flex records and the serial premium records at Honeycombs with banana splits, all that you had to cut out. I am a collector of that. I probably have 30 different
I thought you were
going to
say,
like
Justin knows how much of a fan I am of the
right.
Whopper.
So if I, right. You know,
they're just such different items.
They are, right. And, but I do, when I see them at estate sales or garage sales, I tend to pick them up. But unfortunately, this one's only worth $2 to $4.
Well, I don't know what's more surprising to me, the fact that the price of this thing, I thought it'd be more, Red Skelton, or that Burger King was around in 1969. Yeah. Like I don't think of Burger King as a 60s company. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people are it's been around forever, but
Well, it might not have been. It was from the Red Skelton Hour, January 14th, 1969.
Oh, okay. So right. It could have been like Burger King was around in the 70s
and later released it. Yeah. Oh.
Quite possibly.
I'm interested, like how was it packaged? Like, did you have to buy a Whopper and then get the record, or was it part of some other package that they
so
put together?
So many
questions. I know.
I wasn't born until 73.
All right, there you go. All right, thanks, John. Appreciate
thanks.
It.
Good night.
There you go. That's a good start.
Random's 312. Good. I like
that. Random's always good. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's go to the text. 847 says, I have a form of a Rubik's Cube called an Alexander Star. What's it worth? An Alexander Star.
I could not find a new one in the package, but used ones are going for $15 to $20.
What are they? They're just
and
different.
It's just a star-shaped Rubik's Cube. but I could not find one like new in the packaging, which is weird because there's like 150,000 of these Alex Stars on eBay, but I could not find a new one for some reason.
Really?
Yeah, but used ones are 15 to 20, so.
That's so more than the Red Skelton cardboard record?
Yep, here we go again.
Oh, man, I feel no justice there should be the secondary. The next hour should be just me complaining about how unfair society is.
Right.
When it comes to collectors.
Yep.
Collectibles. 312-981-7200. It's funny, today I had a chance to go upstairs in the Trib Tower, you know, because this building has been around for so many years, and we're getting bounced out of here.
Right.
And so WGN Radio, the Tribune, we're all moving to different buildings. So coming up in, I think it's April, May or something like that, we're going to be moving across the river to another building. But there was so much history in that. Not sure it's going to be preserved. Do you come across a lot of building and architectural history, things like that at estate sales, or people who may have had, because it feels like every other person I run into goes, my uncle's the guy who did the plumbing on this thing.
Yeah, they're very like one or two off pieces that you might come across at an estate sale. Usually that is auctioned off, like when the building, you know, if they're going to demo the building, that's auctioned off at one time.
Pieces of concrete.
Or you have to have like a warehouse to store all this stuff in, so then that person or company just has their sale in that, you know, environment rather than like an estate sale type environment. But if I worked here, I would be going through the...
the garbage.
You go just go through some of the old hallways. There's got to be a vault in here somewhere.
Greg, what are you doing in a dumpster, bud?
That could be a segment for you. You know, like the Al Capone. Geraldo Rivera.
What's thing. In Colonel McCormick's old office?
Right. You know, there's got to be some stuff here.
I think Randy Michaels raided it back in the day, so I think it's all gone. All right, so let's keep going. 815 says we have a Hams Beer Bear Decanter.
Nice.
So a Hams Beer Bear Decanter. Is it worth anything? What is a bear decanter?
It's basically a decorative glass or jar or container. Glass container, I guess, would be the word.
Was Hams the cartoon that the beer commercial that they'd have the cartoon where the bears were kind of hanging out?
Right, and
was
they
that
had
a Hams beer commercial?
Yeah, and they had a character that looked like Grizzly Adams, but it wasn't Grizzly Adams. And they actually named the bear because I'm all about Hams and Pabst, you know, barware. And that's why I'm here, right? That's why you have me. But the bear was called Sasha. The cartoon bear was called Sasha. And but they used a Grizzly Adams type person who could work with bears for the river type commercials that you remember as a kid.
Yeah, that was Hams, right?
Yeah, it was Hams.
What was the tagline? It was like, Hams. It wasn't Hams is spoken here. That's Stroh's.
No.
It's not Lohenbrau. Here's tonight. Tonight's going to be special or whatever.
Something like brewed in a land of sky blue waters.
From the land of sky blue waters.
I don't know how.
That was Hams?
Don't know how you remembered that, but.
Yes. All right. So a Hams decanter, bear decanter, Sasha decanter.
Here's a trendy fact about Hams. People are turning to Hams more because too many people like Pabst.
Right?
It seems like Hams is becoming...
I will be honest with you. If I'm ever at a bar and there's a Hams opportunity, I'll drink it because it's usually about $2. You know, it's the last of the beers. Even Pabst now is beyond that. It's the last of the beers that are actually affordably priced.
Right.
You walk into any bar and you're like, oh, $5.50. That seems about right.
Yeah.
Then Hams is $2.50. You're like, no, that's right.
And that's the thing. I think the trendiness of Pabst shot the price up and... Now people are switching the Hams.
Yeah, I got a bunch.
So that's our...
All right, so what do we got for the Hams Beer Bear Decanter?
A good question.
Decanter of Sasha from the land of sky blue waters.
They've gone as high as, looks like $500 as high as that. Yeah.
How
but
big?
As low as 100. I'll show you a picture here.
Are they big? Are they like
stuff
you put on
your dresser?
About the
size of a football, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Let's see if I can get a sold one here.
Again, we get to that weird consistency in price.
Right, and they have gone as low as $30, but as high as hundreds of dollars. So, obviously, condition, everything.
Yeah.
But you can get quite a few for under 100, it looks like.
If you put the beer in there, it probably diminishes the value.
Yeah, if it's sealed, still if it has the all that. So.
A608 says, how about a second edition iPad?
iPad.
Turns out it runs iOS 5.1.1, second edition iPad. So iPad 2?
Yeah.
I mean,
the iPads don't seem to be. I mean, I'm sure there is a collectible market for that, but the iPods seem to be getting much more.
Yeah.
Like the first generation iPod or the U2 edition iPod. I saw the broken U2 iPod for like $150. And the first edition, even the like adapters just to power the iPod are going for like $30, $40. And but yeah, if you do have a first edition, do not sell that at a garage sale for a dollar. It's definitely worth much more. And you could probably get the battery repaired on that. But an iPad, let's see.
What does the album that you two snuck onto your iTunes, what's that worth? I finally
buying another,
you'll be very excited to know this.
Buying another iPhone.
I sat down and I said, no. No more. Yep. I went through and I found every one of those U2 tracks and I deleted them off my phone.
It's like it took
me a while.
It took like a code, like a crack. Yeah. You had to go online to figure out how to delete it from your phone. And,
So the U2's kind of dead to me after that move.
Yeah, they
I love that band.
Turned off a lot of people.
They turned me off. I don't need your free. You don't have to sneak that stuff on my phone.
You know, and to hear Bono talk about it, it was supposed to be something like, it's here if you want it. It wasn't supposed to be forced on the phone, but that's where the tech guys kind of messed up. They made it.
It's
so
always the tech
it was there.
Fault. Always
and,
the
you know,
roadie.
Whether he's passing the buck or not, we'll know. We'll never know.
Bono's like, yeah, it's always the guys behind the stage. Right. That was my Bono. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news with Rob Martyr. We'll come back. John. We got a bunch of texts as well. Also, more people on the line. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold.
And Greg Flam.
There we are.
There we are. It's
Bring
the swap meet at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We are evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. Greg and I, we were just discussing that in 2018, we may make a night change. We may move this sucker to Thursday.
Yep.
Just based on there's Blackhawks games on Wednesday nights for the entire month of January. So possibly we make a switch to Thursday. I feel like it's, you know, when...
Yep, I'll be there for that move. But when you guys move the building, I got a thing.
You're going to like it. Dude. It's up on the 18th floor. It's nice.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm just joking about moving boxes.
Oh, that's
pushing dollies
and
stuff like that.
I'm going to need your help.
Yeah.
I'm going to need your help, Greg. There's a lot of stuff. All the junk that we've left behind, you're going to have to evaluate.
Yeah,
all right, let's go back to John. John's back. Hey, John. What else
you got? How you doing?
Hey, John.
Well, I have a torque wrench made by JCPenney.
Okay.
The model is 3827.
That's like
I've been curious about this for a long time.
What makes it's just a torque wrench from JCPenney?
Yes. Yes, JCPenney doesn't make tools anymore.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say blouses with big shoulder pads. Yes, JCPenney's got that on lock.
Right.
But the torque wrench, I'm not sure. I've never heard of a torque wrench.
Yeah, I was looking that up, and I just punched in the model number now that you gave me, and I don't find anything with that model number.
Mm.
But other torque wrenches by JCPenney are between 15 and 75. Mm. And there aren't that many, as you mentioned. They obviously stopped making tools a while back. But yeah, they're not as high as you would think. I would have guessed more than that.
All right. Thanks, John. Thanks for calling back.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Let's go to George. George, what do you want to brag about? What do you got?
I don't even know if it's worth bragging about. My grandmother gave me a box of books that she was going to throw away, and inside of them was I found two books wrapped up, and I opened up the wrapping, and they weren't like sealed, factory sealed, but they were just wrapped up, you know, independently probably by her. There were two first edition 1936, I think was the date, Gone with the Wind books.
Ooh.
Wow.
Ooh, that's got to be worth something, right? You get Gone with the Wind, first edition?
Yeah, two of them, actually. They're both identical. They look identical. They look like they've never even read. I mean, they're wrapped up and just dusty and not sticky, but when I tried to open up the... I didn't open up the cover fully. I just opened up enough to read it, and I saw that it was first edition, 1936, published, I think, by Macmillan, or was, I don't know what name of the company, it was the publishing company, but it seemed pretty stiff. The books seemed pretty stiff. Like, okay. They weren't, you know, handled very much.
All right. Nice. First edition used has been going for, like, 110, 120. But obviously,
that's good.
You know, it doesn't get any more new old stock or mint, whatever you want to call it, from yours. So if you do sell them, make sure you do an auction. And you could probably start a little bit higher than that, maybe $299 auction.
Oh, wow.
$300 yeah. For a book?
Yeah, and it might. I'm sure it would go up higher than that.
Oh, all right. So.
Wow. All right. I might actually just keep them and give them to my kids. Like,
there you go.
You could do that, yeah. Or sell one and keep the other one. I don't know.
Keep them both.
Yep.
All right. Thanks,
all
George.
Right. Thanks
for calling.
What about a slightly used Mike Ditka autobiography?
Autobiography, right?
Where are those going for? Slightly used.
Slightly used.
A little rough around the edges. A couple rips here and there. Probably not a first edition.
$14, yeah, $8.
Probably not a first edition.
Eight plus shipping? I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm just seeing what we can get.
I'm just happy I was able to answer a book question. That's
you're
kind
not
of
a
rare
book
for
guy.
Me.
You went at it. All right. But you'll take it, right?
Tackled that one.
773 says, I got this CD for free in the newspaper, possibly the Sunday edition, Chicago Tribune, When Evil Struck America, the mm-hmm. September 11, 2001 time capsule CD.
Yeah, there's quite a few online. They're between $3 and $20. I could not find a sold one recently.
Are they pictures? What are they?
They're kind of like a picture narrated? Disc, and they're actually a CD-ROM. So
CD-ROM.
Yeah, instead of a...
Well, that was a technology that stayed for a second, right? Can you imagine if you were someone who's just like, I the future is ROM,
right.
CD-ROM.
I remember getting a CD by a band called, they did the intro to Zoo TV, We Will Rock You with George Bush. Anyway, their CD had an actual 3.5 floppy in it.
Oh, there you go.
Where you could actually remix some of their videos with that floppy.
I think I remember buying, in the early days of technology, I believe I bought an external CD-ROM drive for some reason at like $70 and never used it.
Yeah, that's
the biggest waste. How much would that be going for?
Paperweight. That's probably a dollar at that.
I got another one for you. Ready?
Okay.
This is one that I can't believe we haven't brought. And maybe we have brought it up, so I apologize if we haven't. When I was thinking about free CDs that came with the newspaper, the Millie. So back in 2000, at the turn of the millennium,
right?
The city of Chicago commissioned a dance.
Wow.
And the dance was called the Millie, okay? And it was a real goofy, whenever the city gets involved in making art in any form, real goofy song that was trying to capture the Macarena craze 5 years after the fact. It was called the Millie, M-I-L-L-Y or M-I-L-L-I-E. And it was it pretty much came and went because it was before internet time, so you can't always find it on YouTube because there was a video that came with it. But it was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And anyone who's listening right now knows exactly what I'm talking about. They had a reference to Sammy Sosa. You're supposed to, like, swing for the fences, like, rock, John Hancock. Swing that bad nice. Sammy Sosa style. You nothing coming up?
I can't find anything.
How is
with
that
it?
Possible?
And luckily, I was living out of Chicago in 2000.
You don't remember that?
I was living in Phoenix stuff 2000-2001.
Pete Zimmerman, the Millie.
Yeah, of course.
Right. The Millie was the dance.
Yeah.
So Pete remembers it was a ill-advised Mayor Daley, Department of Cultural Affairs.
Huge.
They put a CD
didn't hear
out.
Anything about it.
That was like a video, and it was trying to be a Macarena for Chicago for the turn of the millennium, and it was the dumbest thing maybe created. How is that
oddly,
not,
I can't find anything.
How is that not A, on your list, B, priceless? I have one of those.
I'll keep an eye out now for it.
I got to go find it. I have one of the like CDs, the gray CD slip. I remember it. I've had it for years, and I don't know off the hand where it's at right now. But
yeah, find it, put it up,
right?
Sell it for $2 million.
Two
right.
mil.
Get out of this hellhole,
right?
Once and for all.
Or years from now, it will go the way of Chi-Town Rising. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be. It's better. Chi-Town Rising is a professional. Chi-Town Rising is the bee's knees compared to the Millie. The
okay.
Millie was Millie's got it's so dumb.
Yeah,
and I looked it up online and I couldn't find much. I can't believe that's.
I can't find anything.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Gary. Gary, what do you want to brag about, Gary?
Oh, I was just telling your producer, he doesn't even know who Barney Google was, but Barney Google was a comic strip character, and I have, they made cast iron toy cars with him as the driver. I think it was back in the 20s or 30s. They had three different kinds, and I have all three.
Wow, Barney Google, like the Google, like the Google.com kind of thing?
Yep.
Well, yeah, it was like, it's a comic strip.
No, I know, but it's the name Google.
It's spelled the same way.
Mm-hmm. So Barney Google, cast iron toy cars from the 20s. I've never heard of it. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, just one of those cars in kind of bad shape goes for $127. That was a sold price. So, yeah, but there aren't, obviously, being that old, they're not that many of them.
I have all three of them, and they're all in very good to excellent condition.
And do you remember how they sold them, or was it a premium, like when you bought gas, you got it?
No, I don't know. I wasn't living back there.
I just thought you might know the story.
I mean,
Gary, what was it like in the 20s, Gary?
I mean, these things are six, 7 inches long. I mean, they're heavy. Mm-hmm. They're cast iron.
Yep.
Really big, I believe the premium one at the time cost $10 at the time, and the second one was like a $7 vehicle, and the cheapest one you could buy was $5 at the time, because I saw an old ad that they had in a newspaper, or not a newspaper, in a catalog somewhere, and they were priced at $5. And maybe $7.50, and the expensive one was $10. That was a lot of money back then.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Well, I think you're
that's
at
awesome.
About $400 for the set.
Darn,
auction.
That's great.
Start an auction at that.
All right. There you go.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
312-981-7200. We got Vince. We got John. We got a couple texts. We'll do this. We'll take our last break. We'll come back and wrap up the swap meet. Stay with us. It's a swap meet, 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm in studio with me, Justin Kaufman. I want to get to the lines. Let's go to Vince. Vince, what do you want to brag about, bud?
I have an original E.T. movie poster.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the ones that they'd put out in front of the box office?
At the theaters, yeah. I was an usher at the theater, Old Orchard Theater back in the day.
Nice.
Wow.
And, did they let you take those?
Yeah, they actually gave them to us. They had a premiere of it there, and it was crazy.
Did you get any others while you worked there? I mean, because I know like Jaws is a big one.
I did. It was a lot of weird ones, old ones. I got, let me think. Yentl, I remember Yentl?
Okay.
Yeah, I have a poster of Yentl. I had a stand-up of Tootsie.
Great. There you go.
Yeah,
I can just imagine
great.
You as a young man being like, I'm going to put this lentil poster up in my bedroom.
Right.
You know, I did have fun with the stand-up of Tootsie. It was just a big cardboard. On one side, it was Dustin Hoffman, and on the other side, Dustin Hoffman dressed as a woman.
Right.
And I would routinely put it, like, in the bathtub and close the shower curtain. Somebody would open it. Oh, it was
put it in the front window behind the shade.
What do you got for an original E.T. poster?
There's, like, three or four different ones, and they range $150 to $300 if they're the original movie poster.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, if you could describe it, was it more horizontal poster, vertical? Because I can...
It is a vertical poster.
Okay.
It's still...
Is it the two fingers...
Normal.
Touching like the E.T.?
Yes.
It's that
yes.
one. Okay, that you're probably $140 to $200
wow,
for that.
Look at that. There you go.
Okay, wonderful.
That's a big win.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks, Vince.
Very much.
Thanks for calling.
All right.
All right, let's go to Michael. Michael, what do you want to brag about, bud?
I have, from the mid-70s, I think, a coin that my father gave me commemorating the Illinois sesquicentennial, which I think is 150 years. I don't think it has any real value it's not money, it was a commemorative coin. But I was wondering, what that's going for these days, and I'll tell you something funny we did with it, too. If you remember, back in the late 70s, you could buy alcohol and wine, beer and wine, when you were 19.
Okay.
And then when I was 20 years old, they raised the drinking age back to 21. Well, we used that sesquicentennial coin, which had the seal of the great state of Illinois on it, to emboss fake birth certificates so we could get into bars.
Oh, nice. That's the best story.
That's a gift that keeps on giving right there, right?
Yeah, great. I mean, we hit it with a rubber mallet, and it embossed the fake birth. Oh, it was great.
They'd very creative.
And you said this would never. You said this didn't have any monetary value.
I think you got all your worth on it that you did, you got making your fake.
What it doesn't really show up.
Yeah, it's not showing up, and my guess is not really worth much as it is. It's more paperweight.
But still, I mean,
But the story, that's awesome. Do you still have it by chance?
Yeah, I do have it. And it still has a little ink on it.
Yeah.
I've never bothered to clean it up. It was a big coin. I mean, it's about 2.5 inches in diameter. So
yeah.
It was bigger than a dollar. Bigger than a dollar
right.
coin.
You got to leave it out. That's a good conversation.
It is. Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Michael.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Man. Thanks for calling. All right. Let's go back to John. John, you're on fire tonight.
Uh-oh.
Just finding your way in.
Hi, guys.
Hey, a different John. This is a different John. So many Johns, you can't keep track. All right, John, what do you got, buddy?
Yeah, we bought a house in Lake Geneva, an old house, and it had this wood-burning stove in it, the kind that you would cook on if you were back in the frontier days.
Right.
And it says West Bend Malleable on the side. It's big, and it's, you know, is this thing worth anything?
I'm sure it is.
Do you still use it, or is it just pulled out, or...
It's sitting in the garage on a dolly right now.
Yeah they've gone as high.
It weighs about 500 pounds.
That's the worst. Of course it does.
It's the kind that has the burner plates on top, six of them.
Right.
It has an oven inside. It has a place to put the wood on the side.
Yeah, I'm not seeing anything with the West
shape.
You mentioned West Bend or the company. I'm not finding that one, but 1928 wood stoves are going from. 500 to 2,000.
So it might be worth looking into.
I was wondering.
Yeah, I'm sure. It
sounds
got,
like,
especially if it's got like a West Bend, logo, somewhere stamped or diecast.
But make sure that if you sell this thing online, make sure you say you got to come pick it up.
Right, 500 pounds.
Somebody else is gonna have to put their back into it. Right.
Yep, let the boutique earn their money if they're going to flip it for $5,000.
All right, thanks, John.
Yep, okay, thank you.
All right,
thank
there you go. 312-981-7200, looking at the text. 708 says, Justin, you need all of, this is Jeff from Homewood, you need all the lyrics. From the land of sky blue waters comes the water best for brewing, hams the beer refreshing, never stops refreshing you. Always sponsored the Cubs and GNTV back in the 60s. And then there's also a question for you, 815, that says, was Schlitz the king in the 50s and 60s, the beer that made Milwaukee famous?
Yeah, that Schlitz still has some pretty good value. I know from being at Palatine, there's some great bar advertising, lights and different types of advertising that they get pretty good money. And then they also had the other slogan for Schlitz, when you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer.
It's a strong one.
Looking at the history of the company, their big claim to fame is kind of the first outside Chicago beer company. So Milwaukee, of course.
And you learn, not only do we evaluate your collectibles, but you also learn something.
One stop
with Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, here on the download every Wednesday night, shifting to Thursdays in 2018. But we'll be back for one more holiday special next Wednesday. Greg Flam and the Swap Meet. Great to see you, buddy.
Thanks. See you at Palatine.